Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here as always to talk about stuff. This week on the show, we're a day late because life is weird that way.
You know, hey, we at least are not missing like 2 months this time.
We
can miss a day.
We have not missed 2 months in years. It's great.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, but we are going to be doing a grab bag style episode today. We are going to be talking about all sorts of topics. A lot of follow-ups from last week.
Yes.
This is kind of like last week part two, because you've got more thoughts on Horizon.
Yes, I have finished. I have platinumed that game.
So platinumed that game.
Played a lot of that video game, yes.
And it's good, right?
It is a very, very good video game, yes.
Awesome. And I have played a bunch more of the Nintendo Switch, and I have not yet finished Zelda, but that continues to be an amazing video game. And I'm going to talk about some other Nintendo Switch stuff, because last time we talked about it, I played it for 48 hours, and now I feel like I can give you a better feeling for this thing. So I've had it for a full week. And we're going to talk some little news, and we're going to do some other fun stuff, including we have a special guest on today.
Our very, very special guest.
I'm Thomas.
That's Thomas.
Hi, Thomas. Thomas is my brother.
Yes.
Long-time podcast listeners, like really long time, might remember Thomas from like a really old episode. I don't even know what the last one you were on was.
I think it was around when you graduated high school, or college, not that long ago.
Really?
Were you
on a college? Okay.
Well, because I know it was at your apartment, but that's all I remember.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was one Thomas episode
at the apartment?
At the condo, yes.
There's been
okay.
One.
Because I remember you on episode 3, which was our Spider-Man trilogy talk.
Why was I on episode 3?
See,
that was a long time
like,
ago.
I don't even remember him on that one. I don't think anyone does, because I don't think he said anything, did he?
I don't remember doing that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, I think you were on that one. But, yeah, Thomas is here for a couple reasons. One, you're home for spring break.
Yes, I'm having a great time.
Oh, okay, that was convincing.
It was a very natural delivery. No one listening at home has any idea that we're pointing a gun at your head to get you on this podcast.
Well,
right
you
now.
Know, I'm just playing Switch.
Yeah.
It's fine.
No, but you're home for spring break, and you have a Nintendo Switch, and you've played Zelda, and you are an even bigger Zelda fan than anyone at this table.
Yeah.
I would say so. Especially considering you got into Zelda, like, 2 months ago.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Better late than ever, though.
So, you can talk about that, and that'll be helpful in the Switch discussion. And then, you've also played some of the co-op games on this list with me, because I played some more Nintendo Switch games from last week, including, boy, Snipper Clips. It gets zanier after that demo. Boy,
that's good, yeah.
That is a crazy game. Anyway, so we will talk a little bit about that. And also, Thomas, you recently played Persona 3.
I did recently play Persona 3, so as long as it took you to get into Zelda, that's how long it took me to start playing Persona.
Yeah,
I mean, I've played Zelda as a kid. I just didn't, like, get super into it.
Yeah, I never played Persona as a kid.
Well, I didn't either, because,
you know.
Yeah. But anyway, you've played Persona 3, and that just gives us a fresh perspective to go off of, and we get to talk about Persona 3 again.
Yeah, it's just been a while since we've, like, been able to talk about that game in depth.
I know you guys never talk about Persona.
No, it just doesn't come up. Like, Persona or Doctor Who, for whatever reason, it just never comes up on the podcast.
Well, because when did the last movie come out? That was... The Persona 3 movie was like August of last year, so it's been a while since we got to do any substantive Persona talk. And because Persona 5 is coming out soon, we definitely don't have time to like do a Persona retrospective episode. And frankly, we don't need to, given what we've done on this show.
This podcast is the Persona retrospective podcast.
Yes. So this, I think, will be a nice little palate cleanser before we get into Persona 5 in a couple of weeks. And we have someone new to talk about, which gives us new things to kind of bounce off of with Persona 3. So
it'll be a lot of fun.
It'll be so much fun.
Because, you know, we've definitely converted, I know, some listeners to being Persona fans, and that's great.
Like me.
But they don't like, you know, come live at my house, so I can't talk to them.
Yeah,
at least
exactly.
I hope they do. Well, I love you, like, listeners, but I don't want you to come, like, live in my house.
It's like there's the 2.5-hour podcast, and then there's the rest of the week when Jonathan's just talking about how much he loves Persona.
It is just a sort of a nonstop thing with us, isn't it?
It's kind of hard not to get into it after all that time.
I mean, and it is another thing, a whole other thing, where with Persona, I feel like you have to infect people with it. It's like you have to bring it into other people you know, and you have to bring it into their lives, because it's something you have to talk about. It's just this, like, deep primal need, because it's such a strange, bizarre, amazing thing. That's like, when I brought it up on the podcast, I was like, I just need to bounce this fucking insane video game off of somebody in my life because I need to talk to someone. And I'm glad that it's from that vector it is going out into the world.
Yes. Yeah, because there is a definite before and after point of hearing someone talk about Persona before you've played Persona, they sound like a raving lunatic.
Yeah.
And I know I've sounded like that to Thomas.
Well, the other big thing about Persona is you also have played me some of the soundtracks for 3 and 4. and more recently 5, but it's like you describing the game and hearing like the jazz soundtrack and being like, I promise this is the most awesome thing you'll ever do. It's like, it's kind of hard to actually believe that, but it's enough to get someone interested.
The context does matter with some of those things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, cool. Let's go ahead and get started with some stuff. Sean, do you have any like stuff before we get into like substantive like Horizon stuff?
I've got a little bit of stuff. Actually, just to sort of like piggyback off of that discussion, going back to Persona 5 a little bit, I think it's interesting that reviewers and stuff have started getting English copies of Persona 5, even though it's like a month out from the game.
They got it in February. Did you see that? Yeah.
Yeah, and it's only now like preview embargoes are starting to lift. They lifted last week, and that has been a really weird experience for me in a way I've never had, because I've just never seen a movie or played a game or anything like that before it has gotten a wide release anywhere. And so having played that game in October, I was looking at my save the other day, and I finished that game on October 29th, 2016. So it's been a bit, like a good chunk of time since I finished that game. And I realized watching some videos of reviewers talking about like, oh, this is Persona 5, it's finally here, and doing like a 12-minute YouTube video or something talking about like the first dungeon in the game. That's like, I know more about this video game than these people do because I already have finished it. I put in over 120 hours into this video game already. And it's like, I have been living in this weird dream this whole time where Persona 5 was not a real thing in my life because I didn't have that experience of being able to talk to someone about it for real, because nobody else I know could actually play the game because it wasn't in the fucking language they understood. And so now, finally, it's like it's coming out into the world. I'm like, no, that's right. Persona 5 is a real video game. It is real, and other people can see it. It's not this bizarre fever dream I had about me living in a fucking apartment in Tokyo with my talking cat.
Well, that would be a hell of a fever dream.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I have not had that with a video game. I've had that with film festivals, where I have reviewed movies like a year or two before they actually get distribution or something. So I've seen that a little bit, and it is definitely a surreal thing where people will start to discover a movie, and it's like, I reviewed that. Like, that movie that was on my top 10 list last year.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing like that. So I kind of understand that.
Yeah, it's definitely the position I'm going to be in, where in my mind, that is just totally a 2016 video game, because I played it in 2016, and now it's all going to be like a huge 2017 video game thing. Like, everyone on all the fucking video game podcasts I listen to are going to talk about it. It's going to be on top 10, like, Game of the Year discussions, and
it's going to eat up a bit of our podcast.
It's going to eat up a lot of our podcast, and it's great that is happening, and it's also just a weird sort of psychological experience to have, like, put that game to bed and, like, finished it and, like, processed it, and then now it's coming back up for everyone else to play. Yeah. And I'm just very excited to be able to talk about it fucking finally after all of these months.
The length of time that critics got it early, though, does indicate that I think Atlas probably moved it later less for, like, technical things than April's probably just a better release window for that game.
Yeah.
Which I understand. I think mid-February, given the pile-up we are currently in and facing, it probably April was better.
Yeah. And it's just the kind of game that reviewers need a lot of time to play. Not just to play through the game because it's a long game, but it's also something that, like, if you're trying to write a review of that, it is such a complicated, bizarre thing to try to explain in text, in words. It's just, you can't convey it all the way.
And hey, if anyone from Atlas is listening, I promise you, you will get your money's worth if you send us a copy of Persona 5. We will fucking talk about it.
I mean, if we really wanted to, I could review, I could spoil everything. Like, there are no embargoes on me, motherfucker. I finished that game.
And you bought it legally.
I bought it legally, yes. I bought it using points I bought on fucking PlayAsia or whatever. So it's technically probably legal. That seems all fine. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of dark business I had to do to make that Japanese PSN account in the first place, because I did that years ago, but it was probably all fine, I think.
Hey, and, you know, now everyone gets to experience that, because now Nintendo's on the region-free train.
Yeah.
Everyone can just make their Japanese accounts and get stuff. It's cool.
It's very cool.
That's Persona stuff.
That's Persona 5. Persona 5 stuff. I watched Twin Peaks Firewalk with me, the movie, in preparation for our eventual Twin Peaks podcast before that the revival series comes up.
Was it everything I promised you?
That movie is so good. It's such a great movie. And the thing I didn't know about it going in, or at least I didn't quite understand, is that it's a horror movie.
Yes.
Like, it is 100% a horror movie. It's like, it feels like the primary influences of that movie are The Shining and Halloween. Like, John Carpenter's Halloween with, like, the suburban stuff. And that's, like, such a crazy thing, because as much of a horror has been an influence clearly on a lot of David Lynch's works, he's never, other than that, like, none of his other movies are like straight horror movies. They have horror elements and they can be like unsettling and terrifying, but they are not horror movies.
The closest in tone is like Eraserhead.
Yeah.
In terms of deeply unsettling you, but Eraserhead does not belong to any genre, so.
Exactly, yeah.
So. I think Fire Walk With Me is not Twin Peaks the TV show. It is a different genre. It is a different tone. It does not have the same main character, and that is what I love about it. It is a David Lynch movie. You could watch it separate from the show. I don't think that's the best way to enjoy it, because it is in conversation with the show. But I'm so glad you agree, because I cannot wait to talk about that movie. And I just, obviously there's a big cult following around that film, but it is still kind of dogged by that initial critical reception, which I understand.
Yeah.
But to me, is way, 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 way off.
Yeah, it's like, there are a lot of circumstances around, like, I think, like, the Twin Peaks cultural phenomena of the early 90s and stuff like that, that, like, it makes sense why critics would have responded to this movie in that way at that time. But it is such a massive, like, bad call on their part. It is a fantastic movie. It is, like, legitimately one of the best horror movies I've ever seen. So. Yeah.
It's one of my favorite Lynch movies. It's great. It's maybe my favorite Twin Peaks thing.
And yeah, it's either that or, like, the pilot or episode 3 of Twin Peaks. Yes. Like, those are all, like, the sort of the top Twin Peaks things for me.
Absolutely. What's your favorite Twin Peaks, Thomas?
Can I say all of it?
Sure.
I don't know what Twin Peaks is about, so.
Okay. It is about a girl who dies, and then a detective agent goes, or FBI agent goes to their town and solves her murder.
I would say an FBI agent goes to their town and drinks a lot of coffee. That's how I would describe it.
Gives
that.
A lot of thumbs up.
Yeah.
It is a girl dies, and then an FBI agent goes to the town and solves the murder. That's all that Twin Peaks really is, honestly.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
It is a show that you can describe, making it sound as generic as possible, and it is not.
Oh, yeah.
There are a lot of shows that way, though. Like, I just watched Breaking Bad. You could just say that's a show about a guy who has cancer who decides to be a criminal.
Yeah. I don't think that's normal.
Yeah, that's not a like, sort of normal genre in the way that, like, person dies in town, the police investigate that murder is, like, you could describe basically 80% of, like, the fiction that the human species has produced with that single sentence.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I misunderstood.
Although I would love David Lynch's take on Breaking Bad. That'd be a hell of a thing. That show's already got some weird stuff in it. Yeah, see so where I, he would take
like
it.
Like, the weird, like, subconscious realm that Mr. White, like, astrally projects himself into, the dimension of methamphetamines.
It's the White Lodge because he's Walter White, and it's this weird, yeah.
Yes, it's the White Lodge for a lot of reasons.
Yes. All right. My stuff from this week is, actually, Thomas, you saw this with me. We went to see Kong Skull Island the other night.
Yes, the fourth movie that is King Kong. There's King Kong, there's King Kong, there's King Kong, and then there's Kong Skull Island.
But the wonderful thing about Kong Skull Island, there's a lot of wonderful things about this movie because it's really good, is it's not King Kong. It is not a remake in any way, shape, or form of another King Kong movie. It has little nods to those movies. You know, Kong acts similarly in some ways, but it doesn't recreate a single plot beat. Other than Kong himself, it recreates no characters. It is an original story out of Hollywood with King Kong that never happens anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're just like straight up, brand new story, but we're just going to take the character. Like, it really does feel in a lot of ways like what, you know, Toho would do when they got King Kong, which is...
Yeah.
He'll be sort of King Kong, but we're going to go nuts with it.
Yeah, like, on the first draft of this story, it was a giant Frankenstein's monster, and then we decided not to go with that. So he's still going to be superpowered by electricity, but we're just going to say he's King Kong.
Yeah. That's King Kong versus Godzilla.
Yes.
Oh, that is?
For those not in the know, including
That is what that movie did.
Yeah.
And it is amazing.
Yes.
Is that what the new King Kong versus Godzilla is going to be?
We can only hope.
No, what's going to happen this time is it is going to be Frankenstein, because they were planning for King Kong initially.
Exactly, yeah. It's going to go the other way.
Or it's just going to be everything.
Yeah.
King Kong, Frankenstein, Godzilla, Mothra,
throw Dracula in there. As long as you have like some universal monster movie stuff, the Wolfman, and you just make them all giant because
make them all 100 feet high. It's fine.
Like, they're doing that Power Rangers movie. They just make normal sized people giant in Power Rangers all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, breaking the Kong discussion.
Okay.
We saw the Power Rangers trailer before this. One, I did not know that movie was real or coming out this month until I saw that trailer.
Oh, it's coming out this month.
Honest to God, I did not know. So there we go. Like, I'd heard about that movie, but like I was out of touch on that, and I think most people probably are.
I hadn't even heard about it.
Yeah.
So, I saw the trailer in front of Logan, I think. I saw it in front of something.
That is some tonal dissonance there.
It seemed very appropriate to see it in front of King Kong, because King Kong is very aware of the kind of movie it is. Or not King Kong.
Kong Skull Island.
It's very aware that it's not entirely taken seriously necessarily.
It's a giant monster movie.
Yeah, the trailer seemed
like it was very aware of like the genre it was working.
It's super silly and it knows it.
And the Power Rangers trailer seemed to be struggling with whether or not it wanted to actually take itself seriously or if it wanted to be sort of like Kong in that it's just sort of aware that it's about teenagers who get in giant mechs.
Yeah.
And the worst part of that is there's this moment where this kid goes up to like a panel and he's like, "It's morphin' time," but he doesn't say it with any like wink wink. It's just like, "This is cool, right? Sick 90s, bro."
Yeah.
Well, immediately after that, you know, there's text that comes up on the screen. The thing that comes up next is go and then go again.
Yeah.
This is awesome, man.
They're trying to play into it so hard in a way that, but it feels so weird because at the end of that trailer is where they have Goldar, who is one of like the main villains from the original show, show up. And in the original show, he was just, because that was from the Japanese side of it, and so he was just like this bad rubber costume of like a big dude that was like kind of gold and kind of looked like an ape man with big gold wings. And then in the trailer, it's like, oh no, it's like this giant monster literally made out of gold flakes because his name was Goldar. It's like, well, no, that's like the fucking Michael Bay Transformers thing to do. And it feels like there is a cool, weird, like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers movie to be made. And it does not seem like they are making it at all. And it's kind of frustrating because after watching that trailer, I went home and like watched a couple of clips from Mighty Morphin Power Rangers on YouTube, which I hadn't seen probably in this fucking millennia. And it was cool to see it again because it would kind of remind me of, oh yeah, this show was just completely insane, and like no single shot on this show lasted for more than 5 seconds. It just like was cut, 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 cut. It was like cutting between English actors, cutting to like weird Japanese stuff, cutting to like the English like San Francisco town, and then a reverse shot, and it's clearly like you can see fucking Mount Fuji in the background. Like, you know, it's an amazing sort of Frankenstein of a show of you taking the Japanese Sentai show and this weird like show about five teenagers that are all just like Boy Scouts basically, like trying to save like nature, and just mushing them together, and it was kind of amazing. And it just doesn't seem like the people, at least based on the trailers making this new Power Rangers movie, have any idea of how that alchemy worked out the first time.
No, the suits aren't even colorful.
No.
What are you doing if you don't have, like, bright colors on the suits?
Yeah, and just people gesticulating wildly and making weird poses. Like, that's the whole Sentai thing.
If you were to do this right, you would have to get a Japanese director and an American director and basically have to make two movies independent of each other without communicating, and then have some dude, like,
totally coked-out maniac edit them together.
Yes. And that would be a... And then release that in both countries, and we would all love it.
Yes.
You know, you said that the suits in the trailer, or in the new movie at least, aren't particularly colorful or not vibrant. One of the interesting things in the trailer that they made a point of is that they pointed out that the black teenager or the black cast member is not in the black suit.
Yeah, they made him the Blue Ranger this time. And they like sort of lampshaded it with that dumb joke in the trailer.
Yeah, but they just like drew so much attention to it, I guess, because it was, you know, kind of a famous lead.
Weird, awkward thing about the original show. But it does, like, it just feels like trying to put, like trying to point it out just also feels weird. Just, like, if you want to just avoid that entirely, just make him the Blue Ranger and you don't have to write a fucking joke about
it. Just let it be what it is.
Yeah.
Because that means on some level the characters are racist. Because they're, like, surprised by it, right?
Yeah. It's
like, they're not okay with it.
Yeah, because it's, like, there's just... I don't see people responding that way in real life. As much as you can imagine people in real life responding to falling into like a mystic cave and realizing they're superheroes and being like, I'm a black kid, why am I not the black one? And it's like, why is that your fucking question here? Who would look at this situation that way?
All right, well, anyway, Power Rangers looks dumb, but Kong Skull Island was so good. Like, I think this movie knew exactly what it wanted to do and executed on it to a level that I was not expecting in a variety of ways. Like, it is very much more of the Toho monster movie tradition than any, I think, American monster movie tradition. But it is this interesting genre mashup where it also, like, has all these, you know, Coppola influences from, like, Apocalypse Now and a lot of Vietnam-era cinema because it's set in Vietnam. Well, it's set directly after the end of the Vietnam War, 1973. And a lot of the characters, like the Samuel L. Jackson character, was a colonel in the army in Vietnam. And he doesn't want the war to be over, damn it. But, so there's all these different cool things going on. I think the director, Jordan Vogt Roberts, has so much fun stylistically playing with these different ideas of having these big CGI monsters and going crazy with it in ways that are wonderful and really you have not seen in a major Hollywood movie in a generation or two or more or whenever, you know?
Yeah.
And at least since the last time we dubbed a Toho movie, basically.
Right. Godzilla 2000.
Sure. And so there's that kind of stuff. And this has way more monsters than Godzilla 2000. Because that was a sort of back-to-basics one.
Yeah. It was a lot of Godzilla, and then eventually you got a alien spaceship, or you got a rock, then you got an alien spaceship, and then you got another monster.
Yes, and then Godzilla just beat him pretty fast, and then continued just to blow shit up.
Yeah, Godzilla 2000 is pretty good.
Was that before or after the Matthew Broderick one?
That was immediately after. It was like the sort of Toho response, where the Matthew Broderick one was shit, and then Toho was like, oh, we haven't made a Godzilla movie in about 8 years, let's just like crank one of these out, right. And we're going to have like 1/10 of the budget of the Hollywood one, and it's going to be 5 times the movie.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. It was pretty great. But anyway, so you've got this interesting pastiche thing going on, and the number one thing that I think the movie does well is just stylistically, it's so cool. We saw this on our favorite theater here, the Cine Capri, which is the biggest screen in Colorado, and it's so cool on a big screen because the cinematography is outstanding. Even though there's a lot of CGI, this was shot all on location in, I think, Hawaii and Vietnam, and it looks it because you're on those, you know, actual tropical islands, and it looks really neat, and the cinematography gets such great use out of color and texture and things like that. And it's so creative in different moments and just has these little... Again, I like a lot of the Vietnam touches because it's... I've seen some argument online over whether or not the movie is, like, trying to be too deep in its thematics and not getting there, and I don't think that's the issue. I think it's a setting and a style, and I think it gets to basically give it a level of specificity that I like and I think differentiates it from what is clearly going to be a wave of monster movies that we're going to be making as this movie sets up. But I think differentiates it enough and gives the characters interesting motivations. Like the Samuel L. Jackson character basically, you know, feels mad that they didn't get to win the war in Vietnam, so he's going to win the war on Kong. And I think people saying that, like, the movie is not aware of its own themes, I think it's aware that what that is it's a great B-movie motivation. That is a, like, classic B-movie-style motivation, which is the war guy wants to win the war, but he doesn't have a war, so he meets a giant monkey and he's going to kill that thing.
What's great about that, and maybe I'm only thinking of this because it is Samuel L. Jackson, but that sounds like a character motivation from, like, a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yes.
That's like, I fought in Vietnam and we didn't get to win the war, so I'm going to win the war against the fucking actual Kong.
Yes, it's...
Not the Viet Cong. Yeah. See, that's the thing. I don't know if you noticed that.
It's amazing how the movie doesn't make that joke.
Like, I mean, it doesn't need to. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's, but that's restraint in modern Hollywood.
That it did not do the Power Rangers thing.
Yeah, and speaking of Sam Jackson, like, I love the style, and I think that the movie gets by on that in so many ways and has so many wonderful, like, there's these little sequences where the photographer character played by Brie Larson has just these, there's these little montages where she's like taking photographs of the like army people while they're on the ship or on the island. And they're just these fun little sequences that very much feel like out of newsreels from a period like that. And I think that's a really interesting just thing they do. So you get a lot of the fun style stuff like that. But probably the most enjoyable thing about this movie is the sheer number of great character actors who are in this thing. All just so perfectly cast. So you've got John Goodman as the scientist dude who wants to go to the island because he believes there's monsters there and no one else does.
Good.
Role he was put on this earth to play, in addition to lots of other roles.
Yes, he was put on this earth to play all his roles.
Yes. So he's wonderful at that. You've got Samuel L. Jackson as this, you know, gruff army colonel who's really pissed off at Kong and wants to kill him, and nobody on this planet could deliver the lines he has given and make it sound right. Because, I mean, he has a whole thing of, like, I don't even want to spoil it, but some of his lines in this movie are so amazing, and only Sam Jackson could do it. You've got John C. Reilly as like the World War II fighter pilot who's been stuck on the island for 30 years, and he is the heart of this movie. He is so funny. There's this one scene that both you and I, Thomas, died laughing at with John C. Reilly.
I think there were several, probably.
But he is... Yeah. He's so great. You've got, like... And then, like, you know, less well-known character actors, like Shea Whigham is in this, and he's fantastic. And, you know, not really character actors, but, you know, some of the people who play, like, the main parts, Tom Hiddleston, Brie Larson, they're really good, even though I think... I don't know if you had to get Tom Hiddleston for this, because it's, by definition, a character without much personality. Hmm. And Tom Hiddleston is, by definition, a guy with a lot of personality. And I don't know if... It seems like a little bit of a waste of Tom Hiddleston, but it's fine. And he
made it work.
He made it work, and he got fucking ripped for this movie.
He did.
Which is interesting. So I guess Loki's going to be doing some bodybuilding in the next Thor.
Awesome. Yeah. Let's just have fucking Loki and Thor, like, rip off their shirts and have a big fist fight.
It's all an illusion.
Yes.
It could be all an illusion.
Probably not.
Indeed. So all the characters are great, and I love the way they get, you know, they use their character actors. Like, that is definitely something I think this movie sets... It sets it itself apart from a lot of other monster movies in that the characters aren't necessarily deep, but they are so fucking enjoyable to watch that this does not have the problem of when you cut away from the monsters, you're sad that you're not looking at them. I mean, you're sad in some sense, because how could you not be? But you're not sad in, like, I don't want to be watching these people, I want to watch the monsters. It's like, no, I will absolutely take a giant King Kong and John C. Reilly, and if you can get them in the same scene, great, but if you can't, those are two good things to have in a movie.
Well, they did a good job of also giving motivation to watch the human characters as well, even though, you know, they're not all the deepest characters, just because they're so much fun to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, to me, that has always been the secret sauce of giant monster movies. For the characters, it's not necessarily you want to have a character that is super deep and complicated and it's like has all this, like, these layers of humanity that you want to dig into, because you don't have enough time to create a main character like that, because you've got your main character is Godzilla, or it's King Kong, it's King Ghidorah, it's someone. That's like the giant monster is the actual star of the movie. What you need is a cast of characters that are very basic, and on the surface you can, like, read them and understand that's who this dude is. Like, he's crazy army veteran man. Like, this is crazy scientist dude. This is like, you know, go get him reporter lady. And it's like they are character archetypes that are fun. They're played a little bit over the top to make them pop off the screen. And so when you cut to them, you immediately read who this character is, why they're interesting, why you want to see them, like, they maybe make a joke and you want to see them scream and run away, and then you can cut back to the monster. It's like, it is kind of insane how few monster movies actually understood that that is how you need to construct your characters.
Yeah, and this movie gets it, and then when it delivers the monsters, it delivers them good. This is not Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, where you have to wait an hour to see a glimpse of Godzilla. Kong is in this thing from the beginning, and he is a character, and he is big in this fucking movie.
Nice.
It's amazing, and like his... Like, he has a scene early on, but then his formal entrance into the movie, which is when he kind of attacks the party for the first time, is such an amazing thing to see in a theater, because it's like, it's a level of sort of monster mayhem lunacy I just didn't think we were going to see out of this kind of thing.
I mean, the shock value of, like, the first time he starts, you know, sort of going on a rampage is pretty amazing, because, I mean, there's the action, and then there's just the fact that he exists as this, a being the size he is, along with all the humans, and the way they work out the scale of the action and of the characters themselves is really, I mean, it's kind of special to see something like that, especially compared to movies like Transformers, where you've got giant robots, but they kind of suck, and you can't really tell what they're doing.
Yeah, because for this movie, because you can see in the trailers that they have gone for King Kong being basically Godzilla-sized, as opposed to being like Transformers-sized, which is more or less like, you know, three or four stories tall, which is how he typically is portrayed.
Mm-hmm. Right, like, instead of climbing the Empire State Building, he's as tall as the Empire State Building.
Exactly, yes, that's a good way to put it.
And and that adds to the shock value, where we've seen King Kong on film many, many times.
Yeah, at least three times in like the canonical Hollywood interpretations of the characters.
Right, and they've all added something new to it, but this is just feels like such a different Kong. Like, he is recognizably the character, and I think they get the core of the character right. He's played by, I think, two different mocap actors. Toby Kebbell, who's in the Planet of the Apes movies with Andy Serkis, and he's great. And Terry Notary, who's also a mocap guy. And they do a great job bringing Kong to life. He's got a lot of personality, and it's really good work. And the CGI is fantastic. Like, we commented, the CGI looked a little goofy in the first trailer. It's even better now. Like, it really just blends with the environment fantastically. And, you know, we all love the stop-motion figures and the people in suits and that stuff, but you have the benefit here of Kong can do things that a stop-motion figure couldn't do, and I think it's fun they take advantage of that. But then because he's so big and he has just a different presence in this world, you get surprised by Kong in a way you don't in, you know, Peter Jackson's Kong movie, which is, I actually really like that movie, but it's King Kong and it's not trying to reinvent the character, really.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, but it's really cool. All the monsters are neat. I think this still generally continues the trend to me of Americans are not as good at inventing monsters as Japanese people, clearly, or the people at Toho. But the monster designs in here are definitely a cut above, like, say, the Muto in the 2014 Godzilla.
They're not necessarily just, like, generic grayish thing that's, like, has, like, six limbs or something.
Yeah, and some of it is just, there's, like, a scene with a spider, and I won't reveal what happens with the spider, but I think you and I both looked at each other at the end and was like, that was something.
That was really cool.
Yeah. It was just, it's just, it, the movie just lets itself go bonkers sometimes.
Well, yeah, it's like we have a giant-ass gorilla. Why not have something else that's huge?
Yeah, so
nice.
A lot of good stuff. It's a really, really fun movie. I highly, highly recommend it. And I think I even like this more than the Gareth Edwards Godzilla. They're hard movies to compare, even though they're kind of in the same universe, because Godzilla is much more heavy and dramatic. This one is much lighter. I think this one, you know, if you compare what they're trying to do, I think this is an even more accomplished and just fun night at the movies. And it actually makes me really excited and optimistic for what they're doing with their American monster movies, because I think it's cool that they're doing this and they're doing it well, you know? And I would genuinely be excited after seeing Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, this Kong. If you're going to have those two fight, they have established those monsters well, and I think it will be fun to see what they do with them. And certainly, this Warner Brothers Extended Universe franchise is off to a much better start than the other Warner Brothers Extended Universe franchise, who shall not be named.
I mean, can you imagine if, like, they tried to do the Batman v Superman thing? It was Kong v Godzilla.
We made that joke.
Bullshit.
We made that joke. There's a story point in this movie, not really spoiling things, that Kong, this is often a thing with Kong. He had a family and he lost it.
Sure, yeah.
And we were saying, like, it should be, like, in Godzilla v Kong, like, Kong, you know, or Godzilla yells out, Martha! And Kong is like, Martha? That was my wife! Or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or if it came up in subtitles. Like, yes, they're yelling at each other and it's like,
yeah.
Martha?
That would be,
how do you know that name?
Yeah. It would be great, yeah.
At least they wouldn't have the problem of, like, I'm used to King Kong and Godzilla killing people, so I wouldn't have that sort of reaction to it, you know?
Yes. Although it is interesting, they've kind of set up both Godzilla and Kong in this universe as overtly heroic as monsters go. So that'll be interesting to see what they do with it. Like, I hope it's more of a, they team up, but they gotta fight a little bit. But then team up to fight, like, King Ghidorah or something.
Sure.
Yeah.
King Dodongo?
Ghidorah.
You know, you could get the fucking Nintendo crossover. They're putting their shit on iPhones now. They're just one step away from shilling out to WB or something.
Do a Dodongo free run game where it just rolls.
Yes.
Actually, I'm thinking of a Goron, but sorry.
Majora's Mask Goron.
Then Dodongo's roll in Ocarina of Time. That's true. Yeah. Dodongo at the
but
end,
you don't get to roll as one.
No, that's the opportunity that the iPhone game presents to the player.
I see it now.
This fantasy I have had since I was like 6 years old of rolling up into a ball like King Dodongo and rolling around like an idiot and getting fucking bombs thrown in my mouth.
Continuing to attack in that same way, even though it never really works.
Yeah, it's, you know, hey, he's a giant lizard. He's kind of stupid.
Yeah, too bad.
All right, so why don't we go ahead and move on. Sean, you finished Horizon Zero Dawn.
I did, yes. As I said at the top of the show, I platinumed it. And I didn't even really intend to try to get the platinum trophy. I just finished that game with one trophy left to get because I just, the world is constructed in such a way that is very natural as you're moving from objective to objective to just get the collectibles that are like in your path along the way because they're very easy to sort of bring up your map and see like, oh, okay, there's a weird like ancient cup over here and a metal flower thing over here and like this vantage point thing up here. And while I'm going to finish this side quest, I'll just pick those up and sort of go on little weird adventures along the way. And so I just ended up getting all the collectibles. I ended up playing all the side missions without trying to specifically seek all that stuff out the way I did, like, in The Witcher or something like that. And so when I finished the game, I was like, oh, there's this one really weird trophy about going and, like, destroying these wooden figures in the starting area. I'll just look up how to do that on the internet and, like, do this in, like, 3 minutes. And then it was like, boop, okay, platinum trophy. That's awesome.
Nice.
Yeah, so I don't have a lot of sort of stuff to add on to what I said about Horizon last time because everything I said about it then still held true through the rest of the game. And obviously, like, anything more I would talk about would just be spoilers for the story. But I do have to say the story in the game is really well done. The way they develop it and specifically the way they sort of build out the mythology of what happened to this world like our sort of like modern civilization a couple of decades into the future, how our world collapsed is where the machines come from, like why these machines are animalistic, and what Aloy, the main character's role is, and like what her sort of backstory is in that stuff. I was really worried when they, like at the beginning of the game and from the marketing and stuff, that if they focused too much on those questions, that the answers would not be interesting, because eventually, like, you know, there's so much apocalyptic fiction. We have seen so many stories about how, like, machines destroy the world and stuff like that, that it's very hard to do that and have it like, an original and interesting take. And I was very impressed that when you get deep into the story, it is 100% about that stuff, but the way they do it is really interesting. It's really well thought out, and it's a really complicated sort of take on, like, the role of technology and it, the way that they blur the line between what is, like, what is technology, what is a machine, and what is, like, natural life. Are those things that distinct, like, and how are they blurred? The way they sort of distinguish that stuff is really fascinating. And I think it's a game that if you own a PS4, you should definitely play it, because it's one of the best exclusives on that system. And it also, it's just really awesome to see a new IP from Sony, or, like, it'd be cool if Microsoft could get around to it at some point, to just be like, hey, this generation can have games that define this generation in the way that, like, Gears of War and Uncharted and stuff defined the PS3 and the Xbox 360, and I feel like we just have not gotten that that much
this time. Definitely feels like Horizon is one of the first ones we've gotten of that here.
Yeah.
To be fair, Microsoft keeps trying. They had, like, Sunset Overdrive and ReCore and some of these that ReCore are good, but, like, didn't take off, you know?
Yeah.
For various reasons, like ReCore, you know, being rushed out the door.
Yeah, but it definitely, you know, the Horizon Zero Dawn, the story 100% wraps up in such a way that, like, if the game just, that was it and they never made a sequel, it would be totally fine, because they do tell their own complete story, and that's awesome. That they don't just sort of, like, sequel bait this thing into hell the way that, like, Halo 5 did or something like that.
Or Watch Dogs at the
end. Or Watch Dogs, yeah, stuff like that. I mean, I have to confer to you, because I never actually finished Watch Dogs on that one.
It has a really lazy wrap-up where you kill the dude, and then, like, there's, like, three different mid-credit scenes that are just seeding stuff. It's bad.
Yeah.
And then they never did that character again, because no one liked it.
Yeah, so they're just, like, Lesson tried to actually make a character that is enjoyable to be around instead of, like, playing as a fucking wet rag the entire game. But yeah, in Horizon Zero Dawn, the story concludes in such a way that it's, like, you know, if this was a, like, a kind of independent-ish, like, sci-fi movie or something you saw, you'd be like, oh, that's awesome. I hope this, like, director or something gets to make another one. It kind of has that feel. And but they do have, like, one post-credit scene that is actually very well done. Like, the sort of the seed they plant for where the next story could go is very tantalizing, while not, like, invalidating anything about, like, the story they just told. It very much is like a, this is the next step of, if we want to tell another story in this universe, this is where we'd be going. And it is does feel like this very confident, like, there's absolutely going to be a sequel to this game. It has been selling extraordinarily well. And I'm really excited to see what they could do to sort of improve some of my issues with the game of, like, I think they could put in a bit more variety in the side quests, and I definitely would like them to put in even more machines. Like, there are a lot of different machine types in the game, but it's definitely, like, there's all the different machine types are so much fun to fight, and the discovery process of the first half of the game of meeting all these different types of machines and them getting, like, bigger and more elaborate and ridiculous every time you meet a new one is so exciting that when that sort of ramps down, it's hard not to be disappointed by it, even if it's totally unreasonable, because there's, like, 20 different unique machine types, and they're, like, really complicated enemies, and some of them, like the Thunderjaw, which is the big T-Rex, takes, like, 10 minutes to kill one of those things. So it's, like, they're really significant enemies. But it is just like, I just want more and more and more and more and more of them. And so a sequel has so much room to sort of improve the niggling issues that they have, like inventory management could be improved and stuff like that. And then just add on top of the secret sauce of more machine types, like more different weapons. And I would think it would also be really interesting to see, like, other places in the world in this universe of, like, what happened to Europe? You know, what's going on over there after civilization fell? What's happening in Africa and stuff like that? And that seems to be a bit of how they're, like, tipping their hand of, like, there are other places to go to see and other stories to tell. Because obviously after the civilization collapsed, like, globalism died, which I guess is what maybe some people want nowadays. But globalism ended. No, we have, like, nobody in this world has any idea what anything else is going on outside of, like, this valley in Colorado they're in. So,
do you ever find a MAGA hat?
No, you don't.
Okay.
It would be pretty amazing. It would be a bit pointed. Unfortunately, I think the development time on video games is so long, it'd be hard to put that one in there. But there are like, some things they put in that are very funny. I think I mentioned one of them of the way, in, like, the text archives, you find that they comment about what happened to civilization and like the directions it went in of how they shut down free speech on the internet and stuff like that is that stuff's really well done. So, and it has a bit of that like political commentary in it there. Like, it's not necessarily direct Trumpism stuff, but there is a sense of the sort of bit of a rise of fascism and the push against globalism and stuff like that is represented.
Yeah. Interesting. My real only question of where this could go in the future is, what do they call the sequel? Is it Horizon 1 Dawn?
Horizon 2 Dawn? I think Horizon 2nd Dawn is actually a pretty good title. It's a better title than Zero Dawn. I also have to say, I hadn't gotten to this point in the story the last time. This does not make the title good, necessarily, but there is an actual justification for why it is called Zero Dawn. It is referencing something in the story very directly that is called Zero Dawn. So it's like, at least in my head, it now makes sense why it's called Horizon Zero Dawn, even if I don't like the subtitle, even though it's technically not a subtitle because there's no colon in the title. But, you know, it's not a great title, but at least it has its justification. And I do think there's something about Horizon Second Dawn that sounds a lot better to me than Zero Dawn. I could get behind that.
It's like 22 Jump Street.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, you're building numbers into your titles. You might as well have fun with them. And obviously, it's weird because one is the number that comes after zero, but it'd be the second game. So I don't know.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, it's Horizon Zero Dawn sounds like the prequel you make 10 years later after you made a game called Horizon or something. Kind of like you've got Yakuza Zero sitting over here.
Yeah. Exactly. Or it'd be like the Halo Fall of Reach book or something that like Horizon Zero Dawn would be the prequel book that was released alongside the game or something.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I can't wait to play this game at some point. I don't know when, but you know, it'll be there. It's not getting recalled as far as I know.
No, it'll be there. Your journey with Aloy through the technological wastes of Colorado just awaits you.
That is the thing I'm most excited about with that game, is I love that it's set in Colorado.
Yeah. And just seeing, there's something really amazing about when you like see, oh right, this is set like thousands of years in the future after like the fucking like ecology and the climate completely fucking collapsed and was destroyed. So it's like Colorado, there are places in Colorado that are very recognizable. There are places in Colorado that are very much not recognizable, and it's cool to see that.
Yeah. But I think Colorado's, you know, it's coming up in the world in video games. We got the Colorado level in Hitman, which is my favorite Hitman level.
That's a good level.
Yeah, we got this one.
It's cool. Last of Us has Last that section in Colorado. Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff.
It's a good setting.
Yeah. So awesome. I'm glad to hear Horizon Zero Dawn. He's good all the way through.
Yeah, definitely sticks the landing in the way.
Because
really
one of the things you were saying last time is, what's the developer's name?
Guerrilla Games.
Guerrilla Games. With like Killzone, Killzone games are varying levels of good, but you've always said that the story never quite...
Yeah, the story definitely never nailed it in those games. And those games also do have an issue that a lot of first-person shooter campaigns do of like getting really sort of dull and rote by the end of them. And that is not the case for Horizon at all. Even if it would have been cool to see more machine types, the way that they do mix up all the different fights and like some of the fucking just insane ridiculous shit you can stumble into in that game when you like get out into the wider world and all the different machines are just wandering around and you can pit them against each other in interesting ways. There's some it is incredibly impressive that game runs at a rock solid 30 frames per second, because there's some insane shit that goes down in that game at some point.
Yeah. Nice. All right, well, that's Horizon. Why don't we move along and talk about some Nintendo Switch stuff?
Oh, speaking of stuff that doesn't keep a rock-solid frame rate.
I have heard a lot of stories about Legend of Zelda's maybe not-so-great frame rate in places.
It doesn't bother me too much.
It's never... Well, it's bothered me one time when it sort of froze for about probably 6 or 7 seconds, which felt like an eternity. But, yeah, for the most part, rock-solid.
We'll talk about Zelda in a second.
Okay.
We're going to do some other stuff. But I will say one thing on the Zelda frame rate and technical side of things, because might as well just... It's not really related to anything else.
Yeah.
It does have frame rate issues here and there where, you know, when weather effects and things get too heavy, you get the frame rate drops and all that. Other than this one part where there was some Zora stuff where I felt more comfortable playing it in handheld mode just because there was a lot of combat going on. Other than that, it never really bothered me or, like, interrupted gameplay negatively. And I do think as much as it's getting that attention because it's the clickbait game of the moment, you know, on gaming websites, it is notable that compared to most other open-world games, Zelda is technically rock solid. It has frame rate drops that are not infrequent, but a lot of the other things I associate with open world games, like phasing through the ground or the game just freezing or the game crashing, nothing even approaching that. There are no glitches that I found in this game. Like you said, that there was that one time the game kind of hitched for you. It happened once for me, but for 1 second. And other than that, I mean, it's compared to most open world games I've played, I think it's surprising to people because Nintendo games don't typically have frame rate drops.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's outside the realm. Frankly, it's way above the cut, I think, for most games of its ilk. You know, like you're saying, it's amazing Horizon Zero Dawn keeps 30 frames per second. That's because we've seen all the games that don't.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, just thought I'd say that right out of the way, right off the bat. Counter some of the clickbait stories, because even if it really bothers you, there's only so many much mileage you can get out of that story. Sure. Which is that...
also, I've probably played that game for like 80 hours by now. I have no idea.
Yeah.
There's no play clock. But it's probably only been a problem once or twice.
In terms of like severely a problem?
Yeah. It's been noticeable, you know, many times, but it's never inhibited my gameplay in a way that even took me out of the experience of playing the game.
Yeah. So anyway, but let's talk about the Nintendo Switch, because last time on this podcast, when I talked about the Switch, I had had it for about 48 hours.
Yeah.
And so I had not gotten to, you know, I played a lot of Zelda. I'd gotten to test, you know, how I felt about the Joy-Cons and just the general experience of docking it and undocking it and stuff. But I've now had this for over a week, and so I've gotten to use it in a lot more scenarios. And I was pretty positive on the Switch last week. I'm even more positive now. I really, really love this thing. I think it is just such an amazing console. It is so fun to have in my life. And just, you know, I've been taking it with me kind of everywhere I go just to play for like 10-minute, 20-minute sessions. And, you know, I think at the start I was doing that because I kind of wanted to test it because it was new and novel. Sure. And now I'm doing that because I just want to have it with me. And it's easy. You know, I throw it in my case, I put it in my backpack or something, and I've got it with me, and, you know, you just pop it out of sleep mode, and you're playing your game, and when you need to turn off, you pop it back into sleep mode, and then when you get home, you can just keep playing it handheld, or you can dock it in there, and it's just the easiest thing in the world, and I don't know, there's something about that that I have found intensely satisfying, especially the more I get into Breath of the Wild, and I've also had another couple of games I've been playing with it, but just, you know, especially once you get to a point in Breath of the Wild where you kind of understand the game better, and, you know, you're better at the game, and so you don't feel like you need to be in front of the TV for absolutely everything, there's something so surreal and satisfying about being able to take a game like this with you on the go, where I'm 40 miles from my house, I have to drive a lot for work, and I'm playing this, you know, this game on this little screen, and I can go back and pop it in. And, you know, the closest I've come to that is something like the cross-play games on Vita and PS4.
Yes, but like Digimon Story, Cyber Sleuth.
Absolutely.
But reference in for the episode.
No, I mean, that was one of the main games I did that way. I bought that game twice so I could do it. But as we all know, that's a very imperfect solution.
Yeah.
You know, it's the best they could kind of have at the time, but it was not universal across games. And some games you had to buy twice, like Digimon. And then games would, you know, run pretty differently in the different ways. And this is just, it's the game. It's the console. There is near absolute continuity. You know, in some cases, like Zelda has higher resolution and things on the docked mode, and there's little things like that. But other than that, you know, you are just playing the game, you have it with you, and I think there's something really, really special about that to me as someone who has always loved portable gaming, has always had this urge, though, where sometimes when I'm really into a handheld game and I'm at home, I would like to just put it on the TV. You know,
yeah.
I've spent plenty of hours playing, let's say, Fire Emblem Awakening. And it's an 80-hour game or something. And I'll be playing it, and I'll be sitting playing my 3DS, and I'm like, this is fine, this is nice, but it would be nice just to throw this on my TV. And it's been a pipe dream for so long, you know?
Yeah.
And here, it's real, and it's seamless, and it's smooth, and, you know, there are little compromises in some ways, but I also think it's worth focusing on how uncompromised it is in a lot of ways. That when you take Zelda on the go, the Joy-Cons are made in such a way that you have every button you need. And you have everything you need to play that game. And you might prefer playing it on something like the Pro Controller, which I'll talk about in a minute, but you don't have a lack of the tools you need. It's even got, you know, the full rumble suite on your handheld, and it's very weird to be holding a handheld and feel it rumble, because I don't think that's ever been a thing. Has any handheld ever had something like that?
Not off the top of my head.
I think the Game Boy Advance had a rumble pack for a WarioWare game.
Yes, no, there have been Game Boy games. There was a Game Boy Color game that had one. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head. There have been Game Boy games that had rumbles in
and
there.
And DS had... I never had this, but the DS had Metroid Prime Pinball, and I know you could plug a rumble pack into the GBA slot. So, but not exactly a flagship Nintendo
there's game. Almost, there's almost something like weirdly like Nintendo incestuous about that. I don't know. That's weird. That's you keep your rumble packs on your N64.
Yeah. So just things like that where it's like, yeah, you are on the go and you're with this and it is totally a portable system, like a little bulkier than, you know, your Vita or your 3DS, but it totally works. And, you know, I have not had a problem with the battery life yet. because I have not been in a scenario where, and I guess, you know, the main scenarios for this would be like if you're maybe on a long car trip or a train ride or a plane ride, and you had it was long enough and you weren't able to get to a charger in between. And sure, that would suck, but that would also apply to a gaming laptop or, frankly, a 3DS or a Vita also, because they don't exactly have the most stellar battery life. So
it's been, cell phone.
Or a cell phone in a lot of ways, with if you're doing heavy gaming on it, you know. So it's been totally fine for me on all that, and I have found it immensely satisfying. I think it's a really comfortable system to use. You know, I like this thing an awful lot, and the biggest complaints about it are definitely the things that are not there yet, like, you know, the virtual console.
Yeah, the online suite, right, by and large.
Whatever that will look like. And, you know, just some of those things, it'll be, obviously it needs those in the long run, but in the moment, it's really fun and it has so much potential. And I think the number one thing for me, and a narrative that I've seen in the gaming media a lot that I feel like I need to push back against, is the idea that this had an anemic launch day lineup. Because I don't agree with that. And in fact, my takeaway from Nintendo Switch, I tweeted this a couple of days ago, and I only feel more you know, strong about it now, which is that I have never enjoyed a piece of launch day hardware this much that I've bought on launch day.
Sure.
You know, not the PS4 or the 3DS or the Wii, which we got close to launch back in the day.
Yeah, about a month and a half or so.
Yeah, the original DS. I'm trying to think about it. Like,
come on, Red Steel on the Wii, that hot shooter. Everyone loved it.
I would never have remembered that.
Wasn't Red Steel a sword game?
It was shooting, and there was a sword component as well. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. God, I did not remember that game at all.
I never played it. I just remember seeing, like, that was, like, back in the era where I still read, like, a fucking EGM or something, because I remember it, like, as screenshots on a glossy page is how I remember Red Steel in its entirety.
Yep. Now I kind of remember that, too, from different gaming magazines. Because, yeah, I remember the whole era when the Wii was the revolution and it was black. Yeah.
And it was just like Red Steel was the game they were pushing as, like, this is, it's Ubisoft is making it. It's like the third party Western developed game, and it has guns in it. And, like, Nintendo Denver is going to make a game that has fucking guns in it. So it's like, this is your real hardcore fucking shooter game. And it's just like, no, everyone's just going to play Wii Sports.
So it was basically pretty bad. It was the zombie U of the Wii.
That is exactly it. That is 100% what it was. It was the zombie U of the Wii. And Ubisoft seems to have just decided we're not going to do that this time for the Switch. They're fucking fired.
But, you know, my point is, most console launches, you are grasping at straws for games to play, and you are looking at something that is more a piece of raw potential than it is a fully realized gaming device.
Sure.
And the Nintendo Switch does not feel like that to me. It obviously has a lot of raw potential that needs to be realized in the areas we were just talking about, but as a gaming machine right now, I am enjoying it 100% as a gaming machine without some of the compromises I feel I've had with other gaming machines where, you know, I'll get three launch games and I'll be really disappointed in two of them. Like, I remember my three launch games for the PS4 were Assassin's Creed Black Flag, which I loved.
Yes.
Best PS4 launch game.
I mean, but also it's important to remember, like, with Zelda, it was also on the older consoles.
Yeah. And, you know, then it was like Knack and Killzone Shadowfall. And
I tried to play Knack together.
Yeah, it wasn't good.
That game's terrible.
Did you hear they're making Knack 2?
Why?
There you go.
That is the unanswerable question. That's, we will never know.
Did on anyone enjoy playing Knack?
Mark Cerny, the dude who was sort of the development lead on Knack, was also the lead engineer on the PlayStation 4. So I feel like he was like, hey guys, I know nobody liked Knack. I liked fucking Knack. I made you your, like, fucking, like, the way more successful console than the PS3, which is already a successful console. Fucking let me make my goddamn Knack 2, okay?
Yep. No, I can totally see, though, that the cover of Knack 2 should be Knack 2, and at the bottom, why? Yeah, just, I would buy it just for the honesty.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I was saying is that I don't feel that with this. And yes, Zelda is a cross-platform title. You can play it on the Wii U. But having it on the Switch, it's not so much about, like, it's technically running way differently than the Wii U. I'm not saying that. But it is such a great showcase for what it feels like to play a game on this thing, which is, one, it doesn't carry a lot of the bullshit the Wii U does of the UI is clunky and it's slow to start, and if you don't have, you know, another controller, you're playing it on the gamepad that's enormous and all these other, you know, issues that you have with some of that. And it's such a good showcase for the Switch's key magic trick, which is taking it back and forth, and Zelda Breath of the Wild is so good for that. And so that alone, having a game this meaty, this wonderful, this historically great, and we'll talk about that later, on this platform, just means that, again, I am enjoying this on a level I don't normally enjoy hardware launches. And then there are the other launch games, and I think they're pretty good. Like, the batting average of these 7 or 8 games that it launched with, which there's a few more now, but like the 9 that were there on launch day, that batting average is way higher than like the Wii U's was. And the Wii U had 30 games, but the batting average on those 30 was, I think, a lot lower. Because what,
sure, yeah.
Other than Zombie U and that Mario game, can anyone name the other Wii U launch games?
There were 30 Wii U launch games.
Epic Mickey 2, Assassin's Creed 3, Mass Effect 3,
oh, yeah,
and Mario City Armored Edition.
Bad versions of all of those, too.
I think there was, like, what it would be, NBA 2K13, because that was a 2012
launch
console.
Yeah.
Probably Madden 2013. I think that might be as much as I can do.
Yeah. But, like, you know, I think Fast RMX, which was a Wii U game, sort of. I think it was a game called Fast Racing Neo, and this is a pretty substantial reworking, as from what I understand. I'd never even heard of the Wii U one, and I think most people didn't. Yeah. So I think that developer is really happy they got to be a Switch launch game. That's a really good racing game.
Yeah.
And Thomas,
for $20, it's awesome.
Oh yeah,
it shows the multiplayer capabilities of the Switch really well. It works playing with just one Joy-Con really well.
Yeah, if you have to. And we've done it more with like 2 controllers.
Yes,
but
since you have the Pro Controller.
It works either way. It's rock solid 60 frames per second, and it looks gorgeous. It's a really cool racing game. And it's filling that void that, you know, like an F-Zero or Wipeout would fill, but no one makes those anymore.
I was going to say, it sort of satisfies an F-Zero itch.
Yes.
And yeah, it's the F-Zero game that for whatever reason Nintendo just refuses to make.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, that's great. I have also gotten into Shovel Knight on this thing, and of course, everyone
Shovel
knows
Knight's
Shovel
old.
Knight. It's great.
Yeah.
It's old.
It's
7
years old.
It's 7, yeah, it's a couple years old. It's another game that I think is a really cool showcase on the Switch, and it does have that third campaign that's exclusive to Switch for the moment, and I'm not there yet because I haven't played it, the whole game all the way through, but I know a lot of people are really loving that and think that's a really cool part of it. So that's a game I'm loving, and then Snipper Clips, which is a true Switch exclusive, that's a brilliant game. Like, it's silly, and you laugh a lot playing it, and it's goofy, but it is legitimately, I think it is a brilliant little indie game.
It is really fun, too. Like, it is really simple, but...
I mean, yeah, and you laugh a lot playing it, and then sometimes you do those, you legitimately, it's like, Jonathan, just pop the fucking balloon, what are you doing? Holy shit, you just would pop the balloon.
Yeah, it is sort of like I wish I had telekinesis?
Yeah.
I could transmit mind powers or something.
Telepathy. Telekinesis is moving objects with your mind.
I'm trying to say
communicating. From a distance. Kinesis is to like move, like connect.
Because it's like, when I'm playing with Jonathan, I'm like, Jonathan, if you could just read my mind right now, we'd be through this level.
Yeah. No, because he can't pop the balloons. He's just too bad at it.
Well, I think he put
it me doesn't on matter. He knows he has to. He's trying to. He just sucks at it.
Anyway, but like we've played like through the first world and a half of Snipper Clips, and there's a lot of levels in this.
There
game.
Are a lot of levels.
And it's amazing just how much mileage they get out of these very simple mechanics. And like in a lot of like Nintendo puzzle games like this, like the Box Boy series on 3DS, it really just, it ramps up and becomes really intellectually interesting and challenging. And it is this wonderful co-op experience where, I guess technically you can play Snipper Clips one player. I have no idea what it even looks like.
Just switch between characters. I've heard that it's like, let's say, an optimal way to play that game.
Right. So it is really, it is for couch co-op, and it works so wonderfully that way, and it is the kind of experience that no one else is making right now. And Snipper Clips, like, forget 1-2 Switch. If they were going to bundle a game with this thing, it should have been Snipper Clips.
Yeah.
It is a wonderful demonstration of what the Switch can do.
Or forget 1-2 Switch does seem to just be the thing to say.
Yes. Yeah. Because 1-2 Switch is a strikeout, but I'm just saying, like, you know, those other 3 games I talked about, those were all $20, and they are really cool games to have on this thing, and to play in the kind of bursts that you would want, where, you know, going, like, Fast RMX works great either way. You're playing it on your own, on, you know, handheld, it works great. You put it in the dock and have some friends over and play it, that looks cool. Snipper Clips, either way, works. Shovel Knight is a really good one to go back and forth with.
You bring it across the street to your rooftop party, you're good to go.
Yeah, you're throwing down on the court with your buddies on the street, and you're like, hey, guys, let's, like, stop fucking passing the rock around, and let's do some fucking Snipper Clips, am I right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm going to talk about the Pro Controller in a second, because I did get that in, and I have some thoughts. But Thomas, do you have any other thoughts on kind of this general topic, Ron, of just the hardware after what 1 week? You've mostly just played Zelda, right?
I've mostly just played Zelda.
You don't even have another game for your Switch yet.
I don't, right? my UI, or my main menu for the Switch is really minimalist, because it's just Zelda and then, like, the options along
like,
the bottom.
Yeah, Zelda and settings, that's all you need for now.
It's kind of, yeah. It's been great. It's occupied my time. But yeah, other than like, I have had some more, I've noticed since I'm at home this week instead of at my apartment up at college, I think there's more wireless interference in the house. So I actually get a little more of the left Joy-Con
desyncing
issues. It's probably in the past 2 days, it's probably only happened twice for like 5 seconds, but for whatever reason, I just noticed that more. And again, I don't know if it's because there's more wireless activity where we are.
Are you playing it in an aquarium or near aquariums?
Well, that's the other thing. I'm playing it at a desk about maybe 3 feet from the console.
Are you wearing a suit made out of wires that have electricity passing through them?
I'm not, but sometimes Link is.
This is strange, okay. Because I have yet to experience this.
Well, I think it has to do also, I imagine, with like the hardware build of that specific left Joy-Con. Maybe the antenna is not as good as for some of them, because that's just like something that happens in manufacturing.
Well, and you know, someone has done. There's now been plenty of Joy-Con teardowns, and if you haven't seen this, one person kind of did a DIY fix-it on it, and you shouldn't do this unless you're like a tech genius, because it involved soldering and all this stuff. But anyway,
it's spelled different than it's pronounced. It's a word you read a lot more often than you say.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Anyway, But anyway, what I was going to say is it showed this, that in the right Joy-Con is made like a pretty typical controller in terms of where the antenna is, and that's why people don't have the sync issues with it. The left Joy-Con, the antenna is like a little bit, I don't know if it's smaller or that it just, they have put in a place where it takes up less physical space and is further from like the outer edge of the controller because of how it's built. And this guy was able to basically just take the antenna and like put it in a different place in the controller essentially. And he found that after that it was flawless from any distance. So it seems like it's a combination of things. One, the controller's just not designed optimally. And then, as you say, there's just going to be natural variance in components.
And so having that like hardware design flaw in the first place is just going to make it so that you're going to have more people that if you're like your left Joy-Con is slightly worse than other people's because whatever happened in the manufacturing process, the antenna is slightly worse or something, you're going to see a greater effect because of that design issue.
Yeah.
The other really weird thing to me about it is I can't make it happen.
Huh.
Like it hasn't ever been a big deal in the, you know, in the week and a half I've had it, but like, when I tried, like, in the first few days I had it, I tried, like, covering it with my hands or, like, putting it behind my back or, like, walking further away, and I couldn't, like, force it to happen. So I don't really know what that means, but
it's magic.
It's such a random problem that it's hardly a problem most of the time.
It's a really difficult problem to talk about, you know? We talked about this last week. This is not like the Red Ring of Death where it's just, you can look at it and be like, it just fucked itself. It just got bricked. You know, it's like, and you can just point at that and you can look at the stats and you know what causes it and these sorts of things. This is not that, and it makes it really tough because clearly some people, it is torturing them. Some people like me aren't getting it at all. And for you, it's the kind of annoyance that you probably forget about until it happens because it's so occasional.
The other thing about it is I probably wouldn't be talking about it. I probably wouldn't have noticed it if not for the fact that people had been pointing it out in the review the week before before it launched.
Yeah. So it's a weird thing. Like, I don't know if I should knock my opinion of the Switch, because I haven't had that problem with the Switch, you know? Like, obviously I think, you know, it's a problem and Nintendo should fix it, and if they have any ways they can, either through firmware or if there is a hardware replacement thing they can do for people at some point,
Maybe they can put a silicon thing, shroud around it that'll boost the signal
slightly. A grip?
Yes. Yeah. Some sort of condom that one can put on your Joy-Con.
Yes. Yeah. Joy condom.
Yes, exactly. Your Joy condom. I'm going to be starting my business selling Joy condoms in the near future. I think it just writes itself. For your pleasure.
I would love to see how long you could do that before Nintendo shut that down.
I think I would maybe go about 2 hours. And then Reggie would break into my house and fucking drop me in my sleep.
Yeah. I mean, Reggie has been on the interview circuit and he said they're, you know, committed to fixing it. It does sound like they want people to contact Nintendo if they are having persistent problems. So it's not something that they have their, like, heads buried in the sand about, which is nice.
I really look forward to, like, you know, calling Nintendo support and talking to some, like, random woman who lives halfway across the world as she goes down the list. Do you live in an aquarium? No. Just, like, having to go down every single thing. Is your console near a wireless router? It's like, well, yes. I mean, because the wireless router is, but, like, everything is by the fucking wireless router.
Yeah. No. Yeah, my Switch is by the wireless router. Yours is very much not. Yours is in the room where the Wi-Fi doesn't
reach. Well, that's the other thing. At my apartment, the wireless router is in the same room, and I had the problem once in the whole week.
Yeah, weird stuff.
It's entirely random.
Yeah, radio signals are, as you say, magic.
Yeah. So, Thomas, are you doing a lot of, like, the Switch handheld stuff and, like, switching it between handheld and
I definitely haven't done it as much as Jonathan. I've mostly just haven't done anything in the past week except play Zelda, so I've just been at my TV. Okay. But every once in a while, I have taken it somewhere. I think yesterday I was, like, just sitting on the couch playing it for a while handheld.
Well, I was playing it on, like, the TV, and we were just hanging out.
Yeah, you know, just smaller stuff, but, I mean, there's... I don't have much to talk about, because there wasn't any problems with the experience or anything. It was... It felt like... It's very comfortable to hold, I'll say. It's more comfortable than the gamepad. I think it's more comfortable than the 3DS. Just... Yeah, it feels great. It doesn't feel like I'm playing a handheld to me. It feels like I'm just playing a console somewhere else.
Huh.
Yeah. I'll also say, you and I have not had... Some people are saying the dock is scratching the screen. I don't think that's true.
It is true. Don't just say you don't think it's true because it's not happening to you, Jonathan. Like, that is happening to people.
Okay.
I mean, I'm very careful with it.
I'm careful with it. I think there's a way you could make the dock scratch your screen. I don't think the inherent design of it is doing that. Because the reports we've seen are pretty limited.
But, like, what can happen is, again... There is variance in how things are, like the quality of things in actual manufacturing.
People jamming their switches down.
Or if the dock comes out and it's slightly bent at a slight angle, maybe then it scratches the screen. Like, the reports I've seen is that it's not that it's scratching the full screen, it's scratching sort of the bezel of the screen where it's black, and that, like, that over time it will cause scratches there.
Okay.
Well, that's supposed to be, like, the part that's protecting the screen from, like, touching the plastic.
But people who don't want...
Yeah,
scratches like that'll be annoyed by seeing any sort of physical damage on their console. Are obviously going to be annoyed if that happens to their console. I just don't think you should say that that's a thing that doesn't happen just because it didn't happen to you.
No, I'm not. Anyway, I'm not. I'm saying that's another thing that I think sounds like it's more widespread in the press than I think it actually is.
Sure.
The thing I'd like.
I'm glad that we can both state these opinions with having no data to back up either one.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's hard to have data on these things.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's just something that people should be aware of is, like, if you have a Switch, maybe, like, look that up and see how it is happening to people to know
yes,
if it can happen to you.
This is something Reggie said. They will replace it if that seems like it's a problem.
Yeah.
So if it seems like there is a serious problem with your dock, do call and get that worked out. There's no reason not to. I've actually had many experiences over the years with Nintendo customer support in that regard, and that's actually always been really nice. I have not...
They've never asked you if you lived in an aquarium?
No, but I remember I've had to get, like, DSs and Game Boys repaired in the past, and it was always a very painless process compared to some other tech repairs I've had to do. So, you know, that's nice. It's nicer if you don't have to do it, but if you have to.
Yeah. I think for some people, though, it's definitely, like, if you're worried about damaging the screen and you don't want to pay for a screen protector, which is a totally reasonable thing, just... Be careful with it, and it probably won't be a problem.
Yeah. Be sure not to try to switch your console modes while you are drunk, because that seems like a surefire way to fuck that thing up.
You know,
don't start playing 1-2 Switch drunk and then, like, drop it.
But
in
that's
there and...
that's the whole pitch of 1-2 Switch is that it is just a drinking game that somehow Nintendo made.
You know,
that somehow Nintendo made a game that you are supposed to get drunk while playing it, and obviously they can't just say that, but that is what that game is.
You gotta watch that Funhouse video.
Okay. Yeah.
What I was going to say about the dock that I actually really enjoy about it is I expected it to be more difficult to line up the console with the dock, but I've never once missed or felt like I was, like, damaging anything on the bottom of it.
The other thing is that it's really easy. You don't feel like you have to, like, jam it in there to get it to get the signal. You just kind of rest it.
Yeah.
It is. We were both surprised by that, how easy that is. And I've docked and undocked it a lot, probably more than you have, and I've never missed it. The only time I kind of missed aligned it was when the first time I put it in there with the Joy-Cons attached. And it was just different,
like,
dimensions.
I think,
like,
it's much easier with the Joy-Cons attached.
Okay, because for a while I had not attached them to the system.
It
so
would be way easier with your Joy-Cons attached if you buy my patented Joy-Condoms.
There you go.
It's all that extra grip, you know, it really helps. It's
right
just
up.
You need more surface area, that's what it is.
Now with flavored lube.
Yep, there you go.
All
right. Your screen's not going to get scratched, I trust.
Are they the same flavor as the cartridges?
Yes, that's the flavored lube.
Yeah, that is, yes, that is... That's a very different product, actually, but yeah.
I see.
That is by far the weirdest phenomenon with the Switch, is the number of people putting these things in their mouths.
Well, yeah, it just got viral, and it's really hilarious because one of, or maybe the place where it got started was from GiantBomb.com,
yep.
And I literally watched that live stream where that question got asked to Jeff Gerstmann of Giant Bomb, and I watched it put it in his mouth and had that reaction, and became a GIF. That got passed around on Twitter, and then all of a sudden you like see him like in fucking like local news reports and shit. It's like, this is like weird in parts of my life are intersecting that in ways I never expected. Now everyone's putting fucking video game cartridges in their mouths, and Nintendo has to come out and say that, and we put a bittering agent on it so that children don't die.
Yeah, which is a totally fair thing to say. Yeah. It's weird. Like,
we put that on there so you wouldn't stick it in your mouth, you dumbasses.
Yeah, but now, well, Nintendo kind of should have known if they went online ever, but they don't. So, yeah. Anyway. Yeah. No, but, yeah, so the Switch is great all the stuff we're saying. The other thing I want to talk about, though, is I did get my Pro Controller in right after we recorded our last podcast, actually. And it's great. I got it from Amazon Japan, which was weird. And so the box is all in, it's a controller in, katakana, yes. Which is
controller.
Fun. And sadly, the controller itself does not say, they obviously don't spell Nintendo Switch in katakana. That would be kind of cool.
Or that, Nintendo in kanji is a really good looking word. Yeah. That would actually be pretty fucking cool to have on your controller.
Yeah, but I don't think they really do that ever. So, anyway, but I want to talk about the Pro Controller a bit, because this might be the hardware thing related to the Switch that I am most impressed with. And obviously it's not doing anything super new, so it's not impressive in the same way like docking and undocking it is. But
Nintendo has had a rough history in places with their controllers, so yes. It's worth noting if they have a home run.
Yeah, it's a home run. The Pro Controller, it's not just a good usable controller. It's
not just Jonathan's phone going off.
That is the University of Colorado, who calls me twice a week asking for donations, and I keep telling them, I'm busy, please don't call me.
I'm still trying to pay for all the money I
gave. I'm still paying you guys a lot.
Yeah, I donated you a lot of fucking money.
Yeah.
Okay? You don't need to call me anymore.
Anyway, sorry about that. I don't think it's just a good, passable controller. I think it is a great video game controller. The best way I can describe it, and I thought this as soon as I picked it up, is it is kind of a perfect hybrid to me between the PS4 controller and the Xbox One controller, and that it has a lot of the things I like about both those controllers, but not the things I don't like about them. It is a really good synthesis of those. So when you first pick it up, it actually holds more like a PS4 controller, because it's got sort of the longer legs that have a really nice grip material, very similar to what the PS4 does, but even more sort of, I think, substantial, and I like that about it. And so for me, the way I hold my controllers, I can have my, index fingers on the triggers.
Yes, you can play it like a barbarian.
Anyway, and then my other three fingers wrap nicely around the handles, and it doesn't feel like I don't know quite where stuff is going. And so that feels really nice. I am not someone who plays with the two fingers on top.
Not a more highly evolved human being, no.
I think you could do it. I think you'd be fine with it. I can't speak for you,
but... On the Pro Controller, probably.
I tried on the Nintendo Switch Joy-Cons, and... Yeah. That is another thing I'm looking for in my Joy condoms, is to improve the two-fingered experience.
Yes, they're great for fingers.
Yes.
Anyway, it immediately holds really nicely. It's got a weight to it, but a nice weight to it. Very much like I think what people have always liked about the Xbox 360 and Xbox One controller is that sense of not heaviness, but sort of a heftiness to it.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a toy like the DualShock 3 controller that you're just going to twist it in half in your hand.
And to a lesser extent, the Wii U Pro Controller, which is a really nice controller, but also feels light and plasticky in a way where you're like, this is fine, I can game with it. I'm not going to snap it in half, but it does feel insubstantial.
Yeah.
This does not feel insubstantial. All the buttons, so you have the basic feel is really nice and feels a lot like the DualShock 4, where I just think ergonomically I really like how it feels. And then when you get into the actual button placement and the feeling of the buttons, it is obviously more like the layout of the Xbox One controller, where it's the offset thumbsticks.
Yeah.
I am not one of those people who has ever had an inherent preference offset or even thumbsticks.
Yeah.
I generally like in the past the even ones on the PS4, PS3, PS Vita. That just for
Wii U.
Wii U, for whatever reason, that's something I kind of gravitate towards. But I also grew up playing the Xbox and 360 and right. I like the offset just fine, and it works great here. And I actually think for the way these controllers are built, and specifically the way they do it on the Joy-Cons, actually handheld, the offset I think is really nice for whatever reason. That helps more handheld, I think, than it does on a home console controller. But, obviously you have to keep it in parity. So the offset is really nice. And if you're someone who prefers the offset, That's here, and that's really good. The joysticks are fantastic, very much like the PS4 joysticks or the Xbox One, in that they have a nice big range of movement. They feel a little more like the PS4 joysticks to me, but, you know, they click in very easily. It's really good. The face buttons are big, and they press well and all that. The D-pad is a Nintendo patented D-pad that no one else can make in that exact way, and it's great. It's a really good D-pad. It's also, I'm glad it has the full suite of buttons it needs in the middle. And by that I mean it has their equivalent of start and select.
Okay, yes.
And a share button and a home button. And that's the thing that both the PS4 and the Xbox One, to varying degrees, are kind of missing. In that, I guess the PS4 has one of everything, if you count the touchpad.
Yes.
So it does have that. The Xbox One definitely, though, is missing things in that it has start, select, and a home button, which is hard to press on the new controllers, but it has no dedicated share button and makes sharing an absolute bitch to do on that system.
Also, I think it's generous to say that the Xbox One controller has start and select buttons, because the way they have named those buttons is so far away that, like, I am totally fine with the fucking options, and the touchpad is unique enough look that, like, you can put that icon on the screen. I could tell someone, press the touchpad, and, like, that is fine. The number of times I've had to be someone who doesn't play a lot of video games is like, it really has happened a lot to me in the past couple of years, and we're playing something on the Xbox. It's like, I can't just tell this person to press the start button because haven't spent their whole life playing fucking video games.
There's a button with two boxes on it.
Exactly! It's insane! How are you supposed to, because you can't say, press the menu button, because that's the official name of that button, because it doesn't fucking say menu on it.
I have played more Xbox One than you have, and I would not know that's what it's called.
Yeah, it's menu. Well, what's the other one?
View. Menu. The menu button and the view button.
It's three lines and two boxes. No, but, and, you know, for
whatever comes on the screen.
For the Switch, if you don't know, it's plus and minus, which is also fine. Like, that's a clear, easy thing to show.
As long as it's something that you can say, that someone can then look at the controller and be, that is what this button is. Let me press this button.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm glad they didn't, because you're right, you have to think a little differently with the PS4 and how that's laid out, but it's ultimately totally fine. With the Switch, I like that it's just nice and easy, start, select, share, home. Like, they're not fucking around with that in the way that the Xbox hopefully fixes with the Scorpio, but maybe not, because maybe they're
going to be the same controller.
Who knows?
You could put out an updated controller that has a share button. That does not seem impossible. Does the Switch Pro controller, the share button, is it just called a share button?
It's capture.
Yeah, because I was wondering if, like, how's it share? It's just like an easy reference point for it, but it would have been interesting if they're just like, yeah, fuck it, we're just gonna call it a share button. Screw you, Sony. Yeah. You took our like diamond button layout, so we're gonna call this a share button, assholes.
Yeah, no. Or what if they had just taken the touchpad? That'd be
PlayStation button.
Yeah,
they just put a light pad on it just to have fun. Even though there's literally no way it would ever be used for anything.
Yeah, and then in terms of the triggers, so the two triggers and the bumpers, I think they are great bumpers and triggers. You might be a little turn off. They are not analog triggers in the way you have on the PS4 and the Xbox One. But that said, they're a lot springier than I thought they would be on this, because, like, the Wii U Pro Controller just has, like, it's like a little button for those triggers.
Huh.
And they didn't try to, like, pro it up at all for those. For the Wii U, or for the Switch controller, they feel more like triggers, even though they still have basically the same function of the versions on the Joy-Con, because you can't take those out of parity with each other. It feels like, you know, when I play Fast RMX, I map it, so I race, I accelerate with the right trigger. And it feels really good, like in other racing games I do with that. And if anything, there's something nice about not having to, for some of those functions, press it down as far, like less fatigue on my hand. But that does obviously,
it's something that I don't know if, like, these kinds of games would even ever come out on the Switch. But if it was a more sort of simulation style racing game, that would obviously be an issue for if it's a racing game where you don't want to just be accelerating 100% of the time, that would become a problem.
Sure. And that being said, I just don't play the kinds of games that do this. I don't know how many games these days use the analog functions of a trigger.
Racing games.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, like racing, or like any sort of open world Grand Theft Auto type game where you drive cars.
Yeah, so
Forza Horizon.
Forza Horizon does that, but that's obviously not coming to the, because so many few people make those kinds of racing games anymore.
Yeah.
Like, we're moving away from the kind of games that even use that function, is all I'm thinking. So it might be a little limiting, but here's what I was going to say with all this, is that you made the comment last week that you felt like you didn't like the Joy-Cons as much as I did immediately, but you said this would be fine for Zelda, but if you put, like, Doom on here, it would be hard to play Doom that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually a good test, because that's a pretty intensive game controller-wise. You could easily play Doom on this thing. Now, Doom, they're probably not going to port to the Switch, but something like that, you could play pretty much any type of game on the Switch Pro controller, and it does not feel compromised. And I think that is the first time you've been able to say that about a Nintendo controller since the GameCube, maybe?
That is the right way to put it. The GameCube, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah. The GameCube, I think we said this on the last podcast, it is the perfect Super Smash Bros. Melee controller for, like, any other type of game. It has, like either the C-stick or it not having, like, a Z button on the left side of the controller. There's something that's, like, going to annoy you for any other game. But for Super Smash Bros. Melee, it is literally perfect.
It's easily the best controller they've made since the GameCube, and I would say it's the best, like, in the modern era, because I don't know how you judge, like, SNES these days.
Sure, yeah.
But it's the best controller they've made. It's a great controller. The rumble in it is fantastic. It's the same kind of HD rumble that's in the Joy-Cons, which Zelda does not use a ton of, like, heavy rumble, but if you play some other games, the rumble on those things can be intense, and I like that in the Pro Controller, too. So
it's good. I think intense rumble is going to come in handy for my, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As you said, ribbed for your pleasure.
Yes, yeah. Yes, ribbed for your pleasure. Who cares? It's your pleasure! Your joy condom!
Are we going to get into a weird discussion about the sexual politics of condoms and their advertising now?
No.
Okay.
I think it stands on its own.
All right. Well, anyway, yeah, I really like the Pro Controller. I think the one thing it is missing, and this is something just across the board the Switch does not do, and I'm not sure what their plan for this, if at all, is. It doesn't have the headphone port that the PS4 controller has, and that the newer Xbox One controllers have, where you can easily output audio. There is, at the moment, not an option to easily output audio wirelessly like that from the console.
Does it have any sort of port on it at all for, like, a potential, like, a proprietary headset in the future? Oh, I guess
maybe. Well, I mean, okay, it's got USB-C, and you could, I'm sure someone will make something with that.
Sure.
You could. But it has no other, the only port on the thing is USB-C.
Huh, that's weird. Yeah, because I guess maybe they literally are just like, their service is going to be to communicate through your phone, through our app. Like, I wonder if that is actually how they're going to handle voice chat.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do with that. That's one of those unanswered questions.
Yeah.
So that hangs out there, and I definitely, you know, not my favorite thing about it. It's a glaring omission from this console overall, because I'm not sure where you'd put a headphone jack on the Joy-Cons either, but that would also be something you'd kind of like to have on there for a number of different reasons. So,
yeah, well, and I do have to say that, like, the being able to pipe your audio through your controller into earphones from those is one of my favorite, like, little things that Sony did.
Yes.
That, like, that has come in handy in so many, like, weird, useful little situations where I want to, like, play a game but I need to be quiet.
Yeah,
it's just like a smart, cool thing. It always feels like magic whenever it happens, just because it never occurred to me that that was a thing that a console would ever do, because it's not like an obvious thing to put into a controller, but it's like when you just do it, you're like, oh, this is fucking awesome. Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing about it, and you know, it is the other notable thing with the Switch in terms of audio output is at the moment it doesn't support Bluetooth headsets. Huh. And it does have full Bluetooth compatibility, so they could add that in. We'll see if they do or not. I would be surprised if they didn't at some point add that in, because it's all modern, like, Bluetooth 4.0 stuff in there. So it would not be any skin.
It would maybe conflict slightly with their troubleshooting instructions for the left Joy-Con.
Sure.
Are you using your Joy-Con near any sort of Bluetooth wireless device? It's like, yes, yes, tech support person, yes I am. I'm using the official Nintendo Bluetooth wireless headset, asshole.
Yeah, well anyway, and the only other thing about the Pro Controller is the price. It's $70, it's not $60, which is the standard. To me, the $10, it's annoying that they priced it a little more. I don't think it's such an egregious markup that it bothers me. I think, because I think it's a really nice controller, and for, you know, $60, $70, small difference. I think if you're willing to pay $60 for an Xbox One controller or a PS4 controller, I don't think it's that outrageous to say $70 for the Switch Pro controller. You then do get into the discussion of it, but it's something you have to buy extra because that's not in the box with the Switch. And that's where it gets murky. Overall, you know, that's a decision I can't make for anyone else of whether that's worth it to you. I can just say I think it's a really, really good controller, and I'm surprised by how much I've wanted to use it, even though I really liked the Joy-Cons, and I liked, you know, using them kind of held in separate hands and all that. Pretty much since I've gotten this, though, when I'm playing it docked, I've just been mostly using the Pro Controller, and it's a really fantastic video game controller, and I think those moments when I'm sitting on my couch, playing Zelda, holding the Pro Controller, that's the most modern a Nintendo console has felt to me in a very long time, because it just feels like I'm playing a console. None of that other stuff that you often have with Nintendo of like, if I want to use the Pro Controller on the Wii U, I have to take my Pro Controller, turn on the system, make sure I go to the settings, turn the gamepad off, then I can go in and play with the Pro Controller. If the game allows that, there's none of that. It's just you're playing a game. And that's really nice that Nintendo is in that position again. So those are my thoughts on the Pro Controller. You've used it a little bit, Thomas. You like it?
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I like the Joy-Con just fine too, so I haven't really felt a need to buy one, certainly, but...
Yeah.
Thomas, when you use the Joy-Cons, do you put them in the grip or do you just go it like free-handed, akimbo style?
So I go free-handed. For the first few days I had it, I kept switching back and forth between putting them in the grips and then putting them in the wrist strap grip things that sort of widen them up. I found that was the least comfortable, was having them in the wrist straps because it was like very wide on your hands and it felt difficult to like move your thumbs. And then the gripped, like the grip with both of them in one, like a more normal controller... That's a pretty comfortable way to hold it if you don't think holding them barehanded is fine or comfortable, but it also it deadens the rumble a bit, and I like my rumble, so
Keeping it from deadening the rumble is one of my sort of main mission statements with the Joy-Con. Yeah.
And also I like to sort of take advantage of the ability to play with my hands anywhere, even though that's really not anything practical or useful.
But it is kind of nice sometimes that just I don't know. I had some intense back pains going on the other day.
Unlimited freedom.
It was a lot easier to be in a position that was comfortable for me, not holding a normal kind of controller where it has to be. You have to have your arms in here and it creates a certain position. But so
I don't know if I've ever moved my shoulders that much to hold a controller.
I'm just illustrating.
Yeah, for the listeners at home, Jonathan did make a extremely exaggerated controller movement that no human being has ever made holding
a controller.
I just gotta get right in there. Just gotta... Get up on this controller.
If only there was some sort of condom for this controller.
Exactly.
All right. Well, anyway, let's move on. Can I actually one more thing with the Switch?
Sure. Yeah.
I do have to. I've been pretty glowing about this thing. I will say the one thing that I think is unequivocally a piece of shit about the Switch.
Okay.
I hate those wrist straps. I hate them because when you put them on, it feels like you're breaking your Joy-Con. And when you take them off, it feels like you're going to rip the fucking things in half. And otherwise, they don't feel feeble in the way of like a DualShock 3. They're small, but they feel sturdy. But when you put that on and you try to tear it off, it feels like you are trying to rip someone's face off of that thing. Whoever engineered those things is a monster.
I really don't understand because when you take the Joy-Con out of the console itself... It's like you press the buttons on the back.
It's super easy.
It feels fine. It's totally easy. You never feel like you're going to snap anything. It makes a satisfying click when you put it in, but other than that, it's fine. With the wrist straps, it's like you have to... First, I don't think the instructions in the box that I didn't read anyway tell you this, but you have to open this like white little tab at the bottom, and then you have to slide it on the right way, which they're both reversible, so you can use either one for either left or right. But you do.
But if you put it on the wrong way on the wrong Joy-Con, it will like get stuck.
And it's
right?
Very easy to do that if you're not paying attention. It's not hard to do it the right way, certainly, but it's definitely easy to do it the wrong way. And to take it off, you have to open the white tab at the bottom, which opens down, even though you have to then press up to get it off, which means you can lock it again as you're trying to get it off. And while you're doing that, you also have to press the button on the back. And you have to push with an uncomfortable amount of force.
Yes, that's it.
That makes it feel like you're going to snap something.
So I never want to put one on. I don't think there's all that much of a benefit to it, but...
I enjoy it for when I'm holding the Joy-Con sideways, like when we were playing Snipper Clips.
Yeah.
Because it makes you use two Joy-Con instead of, like, Joy-Con in a Pro Controller you can't even do. Because it makes the shoulder buttons much easier to press.
Sure. It hasn't bothered me enough that I want to maybe break my Joy-Con. It's the problem. Like, also, like, if you look inside of the wrist straps, like, the metal hinge is, like... way more metal-y and, like, thick than on, like, the grip controller or the dock itself or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
It looks like someone, like, there was one engineer who did most of the Switch stuff and clearly did a really good job building this thing. And then a drunk intern who made the wrist straps.
The other thing about the wrist strap that pisses me off is, obviously, if you're holding the controller in two hands, like I said, was a good use for it, then you don't need to put a wrist strap on. If they ever make a Skyward Sword or something where you have to, like, swing it, and you want to have a wrist strap for that, then it'll make the controller uncomfortable to hold because it makes it too thick for one hand.
Yeah.
So there's no use for it, really, for either the shoulder buttons and the wrist strap. It's like, if you could do one independent of the other, it might be more useful.
Yeah. I mean, this isn't a big problem. You can ignore them very easily, but it's in the box, so it's worth bitching about. Kind of like... the mono headset that came with the PS4. It's worth making fun of, right? Yeah,
this like weird sort of like spider thread that they pretended was an earbud set that they give to you in the PS4.
Really no skin off anyone's back, but it's worth making fun of.
Yeah.
I also just want to say that there were about 7,000 opportunities to for me to make more Joy-Con jokes in that conversation, but I just couldn't keep up with it, so I just let them all go. But the viewer at home, if you were thinking of them, I was thinking of them too. Don't worry.
Okay. All right, so let's talk a little bit of Zelda.
Sure.
All right. You actually just beat the game today.
I did. I'm still playing it, because I didn't... I beat the last boss, and I want to get... I can't get all the collectibles, I think. I don't think I can get all 900 Korok seeds.
That is a significant number of collectibles.
I have less than 100.
Yeah,
you've got some work to do, my friend.
I got a lot of work to do.
You're lucky that they don't have an achievement or trophy system on the console. So,
yeah, that's
so there's
nice.
No real reason to do it.
That's nice.
But you have almost all the shrines.
I do. I have 8 left.
Yeah, it's surprising. I want to get your thought on this. It's surprising how little, and maybe this has changed near the end. I don't feel like I get frustrated looking for shrines. There's enough, and they're in enough good places that it doesn't feel like. They're just hidden obscurely. I don't know.
Yeah, finding some of the shrines that don't pop up with the sensor, like ones that you have to do a quest for, sometimes it's harder to find the quests.
Yeah.
But then if today when I was just doing extra shrines after I beat the last boss and was going back, I was enjoying it because I was just like looking at parts of the world I hadn't really been to yet. So I was enjoying that factor of it. But if you're just like, I want to rush and find all the shrines and I don't want to use a guide or something, then I could see how finding some of the more obscure quests that I found today would be kind of annoying.
Yeah,
because for one of them in particular, it was actually the quest itself was pretty funny, but finding it was like there was no indication that there would be anything around there.
Yeah.
And other than that, I don't really want to say anything.
No, I understand. But I mean, obviously, any collectibles in a game, there's going to be some of that. If there's enough of them, there's 120 shrines. But I do, it's amazing to me, like, the shrines are both a motivator for you to explore and a great, you know, thing that pays off that exploration. It works in these two ways where, yeah, if you just wanted to rush and get all of them, maybe it would get annoying, but they're there so that you take it leisurely. And I love that about it. And they're just part of this thing that you just know, like, okay, I'm looking on my map and there's a big area where I don't see a lot of shrines on my map that I found. So there's probably ones over there. And if you head in that direction and say, I'm just going to explore over here for a while, you will find things, whether that's shrines or characters or quests or
death.
Or death. Definitely or death, because
there are a lot of Lynels in the corners of the world.
Ran into a white Lynel, they can fuck you up, no matter how strong you are. So, all right. Anyway, but yeah, so I just want to ask you, but getting back kind of on topic, so you beat the game, which means beating Ganon. Not a spoiler.
Why, at the end of this Legend of Zelda video game, you defeat Ganon?
Yeah,
I have never seen this literally in my entire life.
There's no mention of Ganon in the Mario.
You've only played the very specific Zelda games that don't have Ganon in them.
Exactly.
The Minish Cap and the Four Swords games.
Okay.
And Majora's Mask.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
There you go.
Because he's already been killed in that timeline. So.
Yeah, and technically Skyward Sword.
Okay.
But also technically Ganon's kind of in there.
Okay. Yeah. It's like the Chronicles of Narnia prequel version of it. Like, before you have Aslan, you have...
Wait, so yeah. I just had a realization about Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask. Because at the end of Ocarina of Time, spoiler for a game that came out in 1998, Princess Zelda sends him back in time to be a child again.
Yeah.
And sort of makes this really weird decision for Link of, like, you're just going to be a child again and be removed from this timeline.
I'm taking
this
your sword,
weird,
I'm taking like, your ocarina.
I didn't ask you to do any of these things, Zelda. Like, please don't make me become a child again. Like, I'm an adult. Like, don't do this to me. And it's like, I've always felt there's a weird quality to the ending of that game. But does that mean that when Link, because Ganondorf is not in the past timeline, obviously he's not in Majora's Mask or anything, does that mean that when Link defeated Ganondorf, that he literally removed him from all of time and history by killing him, because he goes back in time to where Ganondorf should be in that history, but he just doesn't exist anymore?
It sounds like you haven't read the official Legend of Zelda timeline.
No, because that is just Nintendo trying to placate you by telling you what they say is the truth, but they know they have in their secret locker what really fucking happened, and they're just putting that out there like, we'll let them think that this is the truth.
So this
but
is a
no,
twofold
that's,
conspiracy.
Yes, there is fucking... Link destroyed Ganondorf, eliminated him from the timeline, and that's...
To be totally fair,
something.
The scene you go back to at the end of the credits, I guess you don't actually see it, but it's when you first see Ganondorf through the window with Zelda. So presumably
right.
He's there.
But if he's there, does that mean that then Link just, like, sneaks into his bed at night and fucking slits his throat in the past to make sure all that shit doesn't happen?
Maybe he should have, because then Twilight Princess wouldn't have needed to happen.
He lets Impa
do it. I mean, that would have been fantastic if Twilight Princess didn't need to happen. I would have been so happy if that...
I love Twilight Princess.
Yeah, I mean, you're a bad person.
He does this to me all the time, Thomas. It's okay.
I mean, but you don't like Twilight Princess, so it's different. He's even worse.
I don't have a strong opinion on Twilight Princess.
You haven't played Twilight Princess.
That's why I don't have a strong opinion on it.
And that is fairly logical, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, fuck you too.
Okay.
Both
okay.
of you.
Anyway, what I was going to say, though, is I'm going to share more of my thoughts on Breath of the Wild in a second, but you've beat the game. We haven't heard your overall thoughts on Breath of the Wild. You, as someone who has... You have literally played and beaten every single Zelda game, right?
Have you played Wand of Gamelon?
I've not played the CDI games. I've okay. also not played Four Swords Adventures.
Because that's almost impossible to play.
Well, yeah. I could probably emulate it, but it's a GameCube yeah. game, so buying it is like $150. Yeah. And it's Four Swords Adventures, so I don't really
Yeah, so it's like, who gives a shit?
Yeah. But you've played every mainline...
Yeah.
And have you played Zelda 2 The Adventure of Link?
I have.
Okay.
I've 100%ed nice. Zelda 2 The Adventure of Link.
So are you excited by our idea of the follow-up to Breath of the Wild should be Zelda 3 in the style of Zelda 2? Because they can't possibly do another crazy open world thing again, so they just go back to the fucking well.
Zelda 3, it's their throwback. It's like it's their Sonic the Hedgehog 4.
Exactly, yeah.
They do episode 1 and very, very long in the future, episode 2.
I guess I'd be okay with it if they were able to do it in like a month and then they could start working on another real game.
It took them okay. no one's time.
Or if they delegated it to a small team of one person.
This is a very small team. Yeah. I will accept that answer.
Yeah,
okay. So, no, your thoughts on Breath of the Wild.
So, to me, it's very different than every other Zelda game, other than maybe the original Legend of Zelda in a lot of ways. But it still feels, despite a lot of systems being very different and nothing like the other 3D Zelda games... It still feels like very much like a Zelda game. And I think that's probably one of the strongest praises I have for the game is that it feels very new and it also feels very familiar. I think someone online said that it feels like playing a video game for the first time again. And I very much agree with that because the amount of exploration that's encouraged and actually fun in this game, unlike many other open world games, I'd say probably every other open world game is it's amazing. In the past, since it came out 12 days ago or whatever, I really haven't done anything else with my life. So in some ways, it sort of ruined my life for about a week.
We've all been there.
But it's also, maybe one of the best weeks of my life. Maybe. That's really sad. But
maybe you might want to temper that statement.
As far as weeks where I'm not doing anything except playing a video game, I really don't see how I could be happier with the game. There are some complaints I had about it.
Like the frame rate.
Yeah, stuff. The frame rate stuff. There was one shrine. You were doing it earlier today, actually.
There's one really bad shrine. Out of 120.
Actually, to be fair, I like a lot of the shrine. There's just this one part where you have to hit a ball that hits another ball with a hammer, and you have to control the hammer with the gyroscope in one of the Joy-Con.
Oh, huh.
Rather than using a stick. Which,
I didn't know that there was gyroscope stuff in the game.
There are a couple of gyroscope shrines, and mostly you and I like them.
Mostly they're fine. It's like you guide a ball through a maze or something by tilting it.
They're pretty creative, actually.
And it works. This one just didn't work.
Yeah, this
and
one...
That's the problem. It's like, I don't know who decided that the hammer was just going to sort of have a mind of its own.
The hammer can go in full, like, 3D, 360 degrees,
okay.
And it makes it... And because... You
that's
have no depth perception
degrees,
on it.
By the way. That's
whatever that is.
360 degrees is just a circle.
I know, but whatever it would be. But
in a sphere.
Yeah, in a sphere. And it can do that. But you have no depth perception of it, so it's impossible to know what you do with the motion controller, how that affects the hammer. And all the hammer actually has to do is move on an even plane, but it doesn't stick to that even plane.
Yeah, if they made it so it could only go in 360 degrees in a circle where it hit the ball every time, it would be totally fine.
Yeah.
Do you think that maybe they... Like, where they had it cut originally, and they're like, they had 119 shrines, and Eiji Aonuma kept on looking at that number, and he's like, no, fucking no, we're putting it back in. What is the least shit shrine that we cut? We're putting it back in. I'm not standing for this.
That's the thing about that's a bigger shrine, though. It's got maybe 4 or 5 puzzles instead of 1 or 2.
Everything else in that shrine is great.
Yeah, the rest of the shrine is fine. You could just, delete that part and have the door before go to the door after, and it'd be a perfect shrine. It'd be great. But... it's got that stupid fucking puzzle in the middle. It's not a puzzle. It's just, the puzzle is like, how can I, like, rotate my arm so that I can hit the fucking ball three times?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm complaining about that a lot now, but, like, after I got through it, when I was playing it, it was like, yeah, that was
dumb. Well, obviously, it's one out of 120 shrines, yeah. And it's 5 minutes out of an 80-hour game or whatever. Yeah. It's minor.
That's the other thing.
But those are the kind of complaints you have about this game. They're very...
Yeah, they're very minor. They're nitpicks. Like, yeah, and I think one of the things I like about the game the most, getting back to positives, is the way it encourages exploration. We were talking about this a little bit earlier with how shrines reward you very quickly and consistently, but not so quickly that you don't feel like you want to keep playing. And the process of finding them sort of, and, you know, just exploring the world, which I think is a more compelling world than even a game like Skyrim in a lot of ways, even though Skyrim has many more side quests and fully voiced characters and whatever. Sure. And, you know, I can play it in 4K on my PC or whatever. But the way Breath of the Wild encourages and doesn't limit exploration in any way is the best solution to the problem that every open-world game has that I've ever seen. And so, I mean, there are two sort of just very sort of in the marketing when they were talking about the game, they said, you can climb walls and you have this paraglider. And it's like, oh, that's kind of cool. But the amount of importance that those two aspects have to the game is kind of mind-blowing in the way it opens up the world and it lets you do whatever you want.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned a quote by someone. I want to talk about this in a second. You know, when I talked about Breath of the Wild on this podcast last week, I had a pretty difficult time, I think, arriving at like a core thesis for myself.
Sure.
Because I'd played it for 2 days. It's a huge game, and it's also so different than any other game ever made. It's very hard to get your thoughts straight on it. And my thoughts have definitely solidified a lot more, and I think I can talk about it a lot more coherently. And one of the moments for me where it snapped into place was the quote you're talking about is Michael Jones from Rooster Teeth and Achievement Hunter tweeted this. And I thought it was a brilliant way to summarize the game when she said, it feels like I'm playing a video game for the first time again. And that kind of, that's the feeling of this game for me. And I think it's a really powerful thing to think about. Like, it is absolutely the feeling I had when I think of the first games I ever played. Mario 64, Wario Land on Game Boy, things like that, you know, in that era. Sure. That were the games that when you pick them up and you're a little kid, and you put Pokemon, great example of this too. And you put in your Game Boy or your N64 and you start it up, it feels infinite to you. It feels like you are looking into a work of art that is boundless. It's not a movie, it doesn't end. It's not a painting where it's just on this wall two-dimensionally. It's, I'm at this bomb-bomb battlefield and, oh my God, there's six, seven stars to get here. What do I do? Oh, that's only one painting. And when you're a kid, you don't understand that video games have limits and they have conventions and they have these things that become homogenized over time for you. But when you play a game like that when you are a kid and you have that childish innocence, it is this magical experience that in adulthood, no matter how much you love games, it either gets lost or it transforms into something different. You know, when you play a Pokemon game now, it's inherently different than when you play Red and Blue, and that world feels truly infinite to you, even if you play it like three times through because you're a kid and you just don't understand that this is a game with limits. Breath of the Wild, whatever knowledge you've amassed of gaming in your adult life and your childhood as you grow up and all that stuff, it seems to rewire your brain in that you forget that this is a thing video games have. That, yes, the world of Breath of the Wild is limited. You can hit the edge of the world because, of course, there's no way not to do that in a video game unless it's maybe No Man's Sky or something.
Unless it sucks.
Anyway, so Sean likes No Man's Sky. So
it's a very interesting video game that was flawed, for sure, but the main issues that people have with it have nothing to do with like the game in and of itself. It has to do with the marketing and the price tag.
I played it for like an hour.
Okay, yeah. You have a very sophisticated opinion on it. I've probably played about, like, in across three different playthroughs, 50 hours of Twilight Princess, and I hate every fucking hour I spend with that goddamn video game. Sorry. I just want to hurt you because you like it.
He's joking.
Let's move on.
Anyway, but it really does, like, just the feeling of every single time I pick up this game, and just feel like I'm going to pick a direction and go in it. Or here's a place that I've been, but oh man, I didn't realize there's a canyon down there, and I'm going to go down there, and maybe I'll find a shrine, maybe I won't. Maybe the only tangible reward I will get from this experience is being in this world and seeing its beauty and experiencing that, and the game allows that to be part of it. And that is, those are all individual components, I think, different types of indie games, like a No Man's Sky, have had, like a Proteus, like a Minecraft, you know, different things.
Sure, yeah.
But to have that in this big AAA game that combines it with so many other different kinds of systems and creates a game that, one, feels like nothing you have ever played before, you know, very much in that vein of like an Ocarina of Time or Mario 64, but it's like, this is a transformation of how I understand video games. I think this helps me understand that moment in time better than I could before, because I wasn't cognizant of those moments when I played those games the first time. They were just video games to me, you know? It really is. It is like playing a video game, engaging with this medium for the first time again. And, you know, I have not finished the game like Thomas has. I have, I think, 80 shrines, I have 3 divine beasts, I have 15 hearts, so, you know, I'm pretty far into it. I've got full stamina, all those things. So I'm near the end, you know, and I could finish it pretty soon if I wanted to, but it's amazing to me how I am in so little rush to finish this game. I just want to take my time to it. I will go to Ganon when I am damn well ready to go to Ganon. Like, I am not in any hurry to see the end of this game, other than I'm sure it's going to be really cool, and I can't wait to see artistically what they do with it. But I think, you know, Thomas, you and I, and Sean, hopefully, when you get to play this game, could just talk about this game for hours and hours, about the different things we love about it, and how many, you know, 3 people in this room, we would all have vastly different experiences with it. You know, you and I have, even though we did some things, we wound up doing the Zora part of the game, we both did that first. But, you know, other than that, there's so many other things that are just a totally different. It is your own experience, and all of that combined, I think, and Breath of the Wild is one of the single best games I've ever played. I think this is, when I think of, like, what are the games I list off the top of my head as the best games ever made, I go to Mario 64, I go to Mass Effect 2, I go to Persona 3,
yeah.
Obviously, things like that. This is in that, like, you know, when I just list them off the top of my head, Breath of the Wild goes up there.
Yeah, this is the only game I've ever played, and within maybe 3 hours of playing it, I thought, this is one of the best games I've ever played.
And it is interesting that within a couple hours of playing it, you can get a feeling for what the game is.
You can also finish it.
You can also finish it.
I did want to point that out, actually. You said, I'll go to Ganon when I'm ready. The first thing the game tells you is that you can go fight Ganon. You can go finish the game.
But by ready, I mean like emotionally, mentally ready.
But that's the other thing I want to say, because you've said in the past that you don't really like open world games.
There's
elements of open world games that are off-putting to you.
Yeah, and I think at the time I was talking about like the Rockstar Ubisoft version of open world games.
Yeah, it is quickly becoming apparent that open world is no longer a meaningful description of a video game in and of itself, because it's just such a broad thing.
It just means like big setting now.
Yeah, exactly.
But what I think the crux of my argument is, and to be frank, we've had a couple of years of games redefining what that means in like The Witcher 3 and Gravity Rush 2 and things, and now Breath of the Wild. But I think my general thesis was, I think there's a drift to open world games at a certain point where you can just become kind of lost in it, but in a way that to me makes me feel kind of gross, and like the storytelling falls apart. And there's fluff. Yeah,
there's pacing issues, and like you say, there's fluff, and there's like just like cookie cutter content stuff, which is the thing that for me is the dearth of Ubisoft style games. It's just like there's 5 different types of side missions, and there's 15 of each of those types of side missions scattered across this massive map, and that's like what you're going to do for the entire game. And once you do one type of each of those side missions, you have played basically what everything that game has to offer.
And I think if you look at, you know, the late generation, early new generation games like Grand Theft Auto V, Watch Dogs, some of the later Assassin's Creed, I think we really hit a wall in how you can tell stories, in that people were just like, just how you tell just a straight up linear story in an open world. I think we really hit a wall where it's like, that's not an effective way to tell a video game story.
Yeah.
And I do think we're in this era now where things like The Witcher 3 are finding much better ways to tell stories. And honestly, I think Bethesda was way ahead of the curve on this. Because I think there's a huge influence Skyrim has had on this recent wave of open world games.
And if you go back to Morrowind,
that
one especially.
Yeah, definitely. Because actually, like, a lot of the stuff that people talk about with Breath of the Wild makes me think of Morrowind more than any other game. And it's making me think, like, this is like what Bethesda has to do now, that, like, for me, Fallout 4 never, like, I enjoyed that game but never quite did it for me.
Yeah.
I think the thing they need to do is kind of what it seems like Breath of the Wild is doing, is unshackle the player in a lot of ways and say, like, go out, like, give me the abilities to navigate this world the way I want to, and don't hold my hand every single step of the way. Don't put quest markers at, like, every single junction of every single quest in the game. Like, yeah. Don't do that. Let me have fun exploring the world and, like, design the game around that being the thing, because that is what the Bethesda games do, is they make interesting worlds, and you want to explore them, and, like, by far the most fun I've ever had in those games is just running around in the wild and, like, stumbling upon some weird lighthouse, and you go inside, and the whole family has been murdered by, like, imps from the basement, and you, like, uncover this whole story. Like, that's what makes those games fun.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me like Breath of the Wild is like, hey, Morrowind had some ideas that were great, and some things that never really panned out for that game, like the combat system and stuff, and we have moved away from that. Yeah, the combat system in Morrowind is one of the most insane systems the game has ever had.
It's not great.
Yeah. And Skyrim and Oblivion have moved away and sort of, you know, made those things sleeker and easier to engage with. But in the obtuseness of Morrowind, there was a magic of being able to sort of, you know, walk outside that first fucking village and just the random wizard drops from the sky in front of you with a fucking fire sword and three scrolls that if you take the scroll and cast it on yourself, and you jump into the sky, you just jump so high you see the whole game world and then fall and die immediately. Yeah. And it's like, no fucking Bethesda would never make a game like modern Bethesda would never make that decision, but there's something magical about that in Morrowind, and I think, like, Breath of the Wild is indicating that that is the direction we need to go back in, is find, like, a happy medium between the harshness of Morrowind and, like, the niceness of, like, Skyrim and Fallout 4.
This is something you and I were talking about, Thomas, is it is astounding how little formal, like, video game exposition there is in Breath of the Wild. And I don't just mean, like, tutorial stuff. I mean quest markers, just outright quest giving and stuff like that. Like, there are side quests, and you can get a quest list.
There are 72 of them.
But that's a fraction of what you have in, like, a Bethesda game or something, you know? It is... So the vast, vast, vast majority of what you do in Breath of the Wild is 100% player motivated.
And that's the thing about, like, I played Morrowind after I had played Oblivion and Skyrim.
Yeah.
Like, on PC eventually. But when I first played Oblivion, that was, like, the first big open world game I played. You know, one of the marketing things they like to throw around with those in Skyrim and some of the Ubisoft games and whatever is, you know, go anywhere. And
like, you see that mountain, you can go to it.
And
that's
like
always
but
the line.
Usually it's like, I don't really feel like going to that mountain because I've got these quests that are guiding me here and they're more interesting than that mountain in the distance.
Yeah, and like in Skyrim for me, it was always you have the throat of the world or whatever that thing is called, like the big mountain in the middle of the map, and it's like, I don't want to go up there because it's a massive pain in the ass to get to the top of this fucking mountain.
Well, it's like if you find the right path up,
then
it's like a cool experience to do. But in Zelda, because they have this climbing system and the flying or the gliding system, and because they, at the very beginning of the game, they say, here's the main quest, you can go fight Ganon if you want to. There's a lot of other game you could play, though, so, you know, do whatever you want to. It's the only time in my, you know, life that I can remember playing video games that I felt like I really want to actually go everywhere in the world. I never felt that way. I love Skyrim to death. I've never felt that way about any of Skyrim. I felt that way about Far Harbor, actually, in Fallout 4, to an extent, more so than you know, anything else. Really, other than Zelda, and I think that there's so much that other games should take away from this game in the future that would be really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, when I said earlier, like, I'm not ready to fight Ganon, and you can take that in a couple different ways, but you're right, you can be ready for anything in this game if you wanna be. Like, I think, you know, I wound up playing the Zora part of the game first, and the Zora part of the game probably is the quote-unquote, easiest to engage with of the main four areas if you wanted a place to start. And, like, you know, for instance, the Goron area is a little harder because the conditions are a little harsher.
There are Gorons in this game? What?
I disagree with you, but
okay.
Keep going.
But I was just going to say, like, but that is completely player-motivated, and that is you making that distinction of whether something is hard or easy. The world just is. And if you say, you know what, I want to go to Death Mountain first, then you can get your materials together, and you can go figure out how to fight some high-level enemies and get some good gear, and you can make some food and get what you need for that, and you can do whatever you want. The tools are there in the world. There is nothing, nothing blocked off. And it really is just about your creativity. Like, when you just said that about, you guys were talking about Skyrim and Throat of the World and stuff, and you said, Throat of the World's a pain in the ass to get up, and Thomas said, Well, but unless you find the right path, and that's true. When you do find the right path, it's a pretty cool quest line in Skyrim when you get up to the throne of the world.
7,000 steps.
The 7,000 steps. It's a really cool part of the game, but you're right. It is a very directed and scripted part of the game, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but when you see how Zelda does it, which is, again, how I got to Rito Village was I accidentally climbed up the side of their mountain and didn't know I was going there, and it wasn't until probably 20 hours later in my playthrough I found the road that you were supposed to take. And I say supposed, you can do whatever you want, but the road that actually leads to Rito Village.
The road that the in-game characters would logically take.
Right. Yeah. But because Link can just, if Link were in Skyrim, he could just climb the mountain with the Throat of the World, and there would be challenges. You would have to, it's not holding your hand. You can't literally just climb anywhere. You would have to figure out how to manage your stamina, and you might have to make some food and do these things. The game is not making it easy for you, but if you want to do it, you can very literally do it. And so this is what I was getting back to earlier. It was like, early in Zelda, you kind of realize the possibilities, and you're like, okay, I get what the game is. But the more you play, the more you play. It's not that the game changes. It's that you change playing it. And there are very few games I can say that do that. You know, but when I think of my favorite games ever, those are kind of the games that have that effect where it's like, the game is the thing, and it's genius. And it doesn't hold your hand in that quite way. Whether it's linear, non-linear, it's a different kind of, you know, way. We're going to talk about Persona 3 later. Persona 3 is a game where you can start it and be, I don't know, you can be feel challenged by it. It's a different kind of game. You can be turned off by it. By the end of that game, it's not that Persona 3 has changed and drawn you in. You've changed and been brought in by it.
It thematically changes by the end.
Well, it evolves. I think that's all there at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I think Zelda Breath of the Wild is a similar way. And so the fact that it can tell this, I think Breath of the Wild tells an incredibly moving story. Completely non-linearly.
It's a very suggestive story too.
Yeah,
it's usually not suggestive
in that like it doesn't tell you a lot, or is it suggestive in like a wink, wink, hey?
There are a lot of Joy-Cons on the ground.
Yeah. The Legend of Zelda has long been the horniest Nintendo franchise. I mean, if you look at Ocarina of Time, it is basically set up with like a school harem anime thing of you have your childhood friend in Saria, you have the main character girl in Zelda, you have like the crazy wacky one in Naruto, and you have the you have the older woman in Impa, and then you have like the sort
of
like
a different one.
Oh you have her too. You have two older women, which is the right ratio. Yeah. And then you have the sort of the ditzy one in Marin at Lon Lon Ranch. It's always been a thing in Zelda. It's a weirdly horny franchise.
You know what?
Very suggestive to me.
Breath of the Wild does that, but it's all men. So there's a lot of men who want to fuck Link in this game.
Well, there's also that with a few women, and it's actually they sort of draw more attention to it, and it's kind of sad.
No, but the game is, what you're saying, Thomas, is that in saying it's suggestive, is it leaves so much to your imagination of these character relationships.
Yeah, you could imagine it that way if you wanted to.
Of my consistent conclusions is that this game is intensely Japanese culturally, and I love that about it. It is not, like, early Zelda games are that way in terms of, I think, the layout of the land and the sort of, like, the forest and stuff look very Japanese.
Some of, like, the monster designs strike me as very Japanese.
The 3D Zelda games wind up being much more of a mishmash of Western and Eastern cultures, and that's totally fine. Like, Breath of the Wild, it is a Japanese-ass game in so many ways, and some of that, I think, is the storytelling reminds me of a philosophy behind a lot of Japanese movies and storytelling, which is those spaces and the quiet moments, and that it... You know, the most powerful moments in Breath of the Wild can be no music, little sound effects, you're on top of a mountain looking out at something, and that can mean as much as a scene with a lot of dialogue and action in it, and that is a very Japanese way to tell stories. And when you mix that with, I think the environments look very Japanese in terms of like the layout of the land and things like that, the shrines and sort of the god structure of this world, and the, you know, you have this...
I mean, the four divine beast things, it's not just Japanese because Japan took it from China, but it's like the four divine beasts of like Shizaku, Byakko, and all that shit.
That's the other thing. There are some creatures in the game. I kind of don't want to spoil it because it's really cool when you first see them, but
there's cool creatures.
There are cool creatures that look
awesome.
Chinese rather than Japanese.
Yeah, I mean, China has the massive influence on Japan's culture, so it's like that is a thing.
Right. Like where Japan would have a cultural equivalent,
but
they like went with the Chinese sort of
the more version, traditional version. I guess. Sure,
No, I mean. But I love that there's a cultural specificity about this game that just makes Hyrule feel like a real place and an inhabitable place in ways beyond what it has in the past, and I love that about it. And it just, as I was saying, it feeds into that thematic thing of this is a game that loves and embraces silence and calm, and that, again, it's not telling you what's the important moments and what isn't. That's player directed, and so some of the moments I remember just as much as like maybe a cutscene is just when I was out in a field of grass and the sun hit it in such a way that this game has brought tears to my eyes on multiple occasions through sheer aesthetic beauty alone. And that is something, that's actually something I get from a lot of Japanese media I engage with, in terms of like when I think of like the films of Yasujiro Ozu or something like that, or certain Kurosawa films, which, you know, very different style, but same kind of thing can happen. That's amazing to me. Like, I said this on Twitter the other day, because I just reached a point where I couldn't like deny this to myself anymore. This is obviously not the most technically advanced game ever made. It's not, you know, a 78-gigabyte game that's running on the PS4 Pro or something in 4K and all this. But it is the most beautiful game I've ever seen. It just easily to me, because of the art style and the draw distance on this thing, that at any point you can see everything in the world, and that the game is just constantly framing itself so that you have the most beautiful cinematic portrait-esque images possible. And it just, it feels like being in the world's most beautiful animated movie, and tied in with, I think, the very minimalist soundtrack and the sound effects they have. It is an overwhelming aesthetic experience to me. If it was just walking around exploring Hyrule a la like a Proteus or something, I would find this game unspeakably beautiful. That it is so many other things that work with each other is what elevates it to be one of the all-time greats.
Mm-hmm. I was going to talk about the draw distance, because that, like, technically, as far as the game is concerned, the draw distance is what impresses me the most.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, going back to other open-world games, it's like, on PC, when you turn up draw distance 10% or something, it's like it kills your frame
rate. Yeah, that's the frame rate killer, for sure.
Yeah. Unless you're, like...
That, it's like that and, like, the density of vegetation. Those are, like, yeah. if a game has those sliders, those are, like, and you're getting shit frame rate, those are the things you need to look at.
Yeah, and shadows.
Yeah.
But, like, in this game, it's like, obviously, they don't render foliage and grass past a pretty close point, actually. But
you
like
can have a little pop in right in front of you, yeah.
I mean, you can see the boundary on the other side of the world from the easternmost part of the world.
Yes.
And then you can see it all, and you can say, I'm going to go there, or I'm going to
try to... I can see that mountain, I'm going to go to it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like, even if you had a perfect draw distance in Skyrim, and you're like, I want to go there, then you'd run into a mountain and be like, I can't get over this mountain, so I guess I'll do something else.
So I guess I'll open up the if you're playing on PC, I'll just open up the console commands and turn my, like, jumping height to, like, 5,000 and just jump over this goddamn
toggle
mountain.
Toggle collision.
Yeah. Or do, like, what people did on the 360 back in the day and just run against that mountain until you
get your goddamn horse.
You get your horse and you climb the mountain.
I've spent an embarrassing number of hours in my life just, like, fucking with the physics stuff in Skyrim to force myself up mountains.
Yeah, you don't have to do that in Breath of the Wild.
That's good.
That's nice.
Or it seems more like they just turned it into a formal system in Breath of the Wild with the climbing.
Yeah.
It is amazing how just that climbing is so fun and addictive in so many different ways. Like,
Tomb Raider has really fun climbing, too.
But it's like a different kind of climbing.
It's totally different, but it's like just the concept of climbing doesn't sound like fun in a game.
It's true, but there are definitely enough games now, Uncharted and Tomb Raider and stuff.
Horizon Zero Dawn has like a very Uncharted-esque sort of climbing mechanic.
But, you know, in Uncharted and Tomb Raider, it's scripted and cinematic.
Yeah. Like with Horizon Zero Dawn, they have like defined points in the environment of like these are handholds and like ropes and stuff that you're going to climb up.
And I'm not here to say...
Like, I'm just going to fucking climb up this mountain, whether that seems like that would be a physically possible thing to do or not.
Yeah, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the approach that those games take, but there is something special about Zelda where, like, it's funny, I went through this transformation where in the beginning of the game it felt like this sometimes Sisyphean task of getting up a peak that I wanted to get up, and I would figure out a way to do it and I'd feel so proud, and now I'm at a point where I have full stamina and everything, and there's still, of course, some peaks that are going to be really hard to get up, and it's a challenge that I just love to do of, like, I don't need to get up to the top of this thing, but I want to see if I can figure out the path up there, and it's fun, and it's amazing that this world is so big, and yet each part of it can have a precise experience like that.
Yeah. The other thing regarding climbing, they take it away in shrines, which is more like sort of traditional dungeons. So there are times when there are more limiting factors to get around puzzles, and I think that's a compelling reason to continue playing a lot of the time.
Yeah, because it does seem like being able to climb literally every single wall in the game, like at some point if you're like making a puzzle, you're just like, don't let them do this because it's just going to make this puzzle confusing if they can just stand and like grasp at every single point in the room. You're going to have no idea how to approach it.
Like if you could do the fire temple in Ocarina of Time, you could just climb to the top of the temple and finish it real fast.
Yeah.
No, but I mean it is something very compelling about the shrines actually on that pacing level that they feel very distinct from the... It's not like it feels like a different game, like the controls change, but just they limit enough things and they push you in enough directions in those shrines that when you go in, you're getting a different experience that breaks up the pace of things. And so, you know, there's no real way to get bored in this game with those elements, you know. Yeah. There's... They bring that up. And then, you know, with the Divine Beasts, the stuff they pull off there is just out of this fucking world in some of those.
Yeah. I kind of don't want to say anything.
No, I'm not going to say anything. Should
just experience it. But...
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
In fact, I think we can wrap this up pretty soon.
Because
I don't want to rub it in Sean's face or anything.
Hey, but... man, fuck you. I'd finish Persona 5 at the end of October.
A good point. You know what?
Yeah, you can go fuck yourself. I don't care.
Sean, what's the... Thomas, how does Zelda end? Like, explain the whole thing. No, I'm kidding.
Does he jump up and stab the Master? If you don't want to do that because I've got a lot of ammunition of shit. Persona 5 is a game... There's like a 500 fucking spoilers in that game. I could just ruin everything.
Well, that's the other thing. If you're trying to spoil how the game ends for Zelda, it's like, you know what the final quest is at the beginning of the game.
Yeah, defeat Ganon. Is that the end of the game? Do you defeat Ganon?
Yeah.
It is interesting.
Well, I mean, maybe you don't. I don't know. Maybe you suck and you don't.
And maybe you die and then it creates another alternate timeline where Link died and then...
I was going to say, it wipes your save and you have to do the Shrine of Resurrection again and start all over.
That would be crazy.
And then they just cut and paste everything. When it said 100 years, it's 200.
No, what it does is if you die in the game, you know the bittering agent that they put on the quote-unquote bittering agent on the Switch? Switch card.
Yeah.
The reason why everyone thinks that every Switch card just has that is because the only fucking Switch card that anyone owns is Legend of Zelda. Legend of Zelda is the only game that has it on there because when you die, that's actually an acid that is activated and it just dissolves the cartridge inside your Switch.
I thought you were going to say it floods the room and kills you.
Or that as well. Yeah, it's just it fucking oxidizes and sprays out of the Switch fan
as an aerosol,
and so it's like you breathe it in, and when you breathe it, it's a toxic gas. When you just lick it, you're mostly fine.
It is amazing that though with Zelda, to bring it back
to the ground. World of Sanity. Yeah. Sure, let's go back there for a second.
When you talk about spoilers with this game, spoilers are not, to me, story spoilers in this game. They are experience spoilers, and it actually makes it hard to talk about, even with you and I have played a similar amount of the game, Thomas. There are still things we could, ignoring that you finished it, that we could spoil just from like you saw me the other day, like I found a way to find Koroks that you had not even thought about, and it's like, oh my god, and it's just moments like that. That it's such a special experience, and it's one of those gaming things that I will remember for as long as I live, the experience of playing this game for the first time. And it is just, the gaming pileup we are having in 2017 is so fucking insane.
Yeah.
But that there is even a possibility that Breath of the Wild wouldn't be number one game of the year, would be insane in any other year. But guess what? We've still got Persona 5 and Mario Odyssey and Mass Effect Andromeda. Like, my four favorite series are just having games this year, because fuck it. It's, you know, and not to mention all the other games that we could get and the ones we don't know about yet.
Yeah.
It's an insane year, and with all that said, Breath of the Wild, I think even in over the last couple years of games, this feels to me like something special and like a moment of a different thing in gaming, an evolution that is fascinating to me. And you know, Thomas, I said this to you the other day, that this also feels like, I love the way this game kind of nods to the continuity of all Zelda, of all, you know, characters and things from the other games. That
Wand of Gamelon, all the Zelda.
Not those ones. But that it kind of feels like, you know how, you know, Doom 2016 was just called Doom. Because it's a Doom game. You kind of could have just called... I love the title Breath of the Wild. I think it's a great title. You could have just called this, like, The Legend of Zelda. And just because it kind of feels like the ultimate... It's The Legend of Zelda.
Sure, yeah.
And it is the ultimate version of itself. And, yeah, I just...
That's another thing, though. It doesn't... It also... I was saying quite a while ago now, it feels both very new like that and also very familiar.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you know, it doesn't make me feel like I never want to go back and play... Twilight Princess again.
You're in a
Ocarina of Time place. Again.
There you go. That's now you're talking my life. It's
a different type of game than the other 3D Zeldas. Yeah. Like the other 3D Zeldas and this, they are both 3D games, you know, but other than that, they're as different as Link to the Past and Ocarina of Time. You know? And
that's something Nintendo's always been good at, though. It's like when Ocarina of Time came out, it wasn't like you felt like a Link to the Past was less playable. Like when Skyrim came out, it was like, Morrowind's kind of tough to play now.
Yeah, there's definitely, you go back and you're like, wait, this is a real-time first-person action combat where everything is based on dice rolls? What kind of maniac designed this thing?
It's like, I guess I'll use some mods or something.
I actually think maybe that's the point I want to end on, is the level of charm in this game, too, that I think they actually made a smart decision in using the amount of voice acting they did, because that means that you can have a scene where you're in Goron City and there's a guy standing by the inn, and when you get up, he'll go, and he'll make the funny sound, and I wouldn't want to live in a world where a Zelda game didn't get to make those funny sounds.
Or the Dancing Korok.
The Dancing Korok, all those things. It's amazing.
Well, before we move on, I wanted to pose to you, Thomas, the same question I posed to Jonathan at the end of the last podcast, and I kind of joked about earlier. What do you see Legend of Zelda being going forward then? Like, if this is such a different thing, it seems like such a big sea change, do you want a, like, effective Breath of the Wild 2 in the way that, like, not necessarily Majora's Mask, but, like Wind Waker, like Ocarina to Wind Waker, do you see that, or do you think it needs to go back to maybe the more classical 3D style?
I could see it going either way. I think if they did something more like Twilight Princess or The Wind Waker again, I think, you know, they could do that well. They could probably do it a little faster. If they wanted to do something like this again, I'm curious to see what the DLC is, especially the second DLC, the story part. I wonder sort of what that is. But without making a whole new world, which I have no idea how long it would take to do something, you know, better than this or bigger than this, you know, I think whatever they decide to do, if they're smart about it, it'll be good. So...
But do you see, like, yeah, but like in your, like, if you imagine, again, it would be hard to do, but imagine, like, if they made another Legend of Zelda game in the style of Breath of the Wild, do you think that that would be, like, kind of unsatisfying, because part of what is fun about Breath of the Wild is how different and new and crazy everything is, so, like, you're exploring everything so fresh, and, like, if they make another giant open world that has a Death Mountain and a Zora area and a Rito area and, like, all that stuff, do you think that it would just, like, not... It would have what would happen to these games happened to like the 3D Zelda games and stuff.
Well, I mean, I could see how you know it would be less special, but I could also see how they could reasonably do something that's very similar to this with a maybe not even a bigger world. Just they could go outside of Hyrule or something, yeah. Or you redesign Hyrule again. They don't, you know, the
put a giant moon in the sky and call it Termina and then call it a day.
I mean, sure, or you know. I mean, I think there are ways they could take the strong concepts and make something. I don't think they can do a reinvention this big again.
Yeah.
In the near future, certainly. But go ahead.
I'll put it this way: I have a couple thoughts on this, like new thoughts.
Yeah.
I do think you could do more with this. I think you could take almost like a Link's Awakening approach and say totally different world, very different, but like maybe we don't go for size, we go for density. And have something like that. And that could be fun, but I do think there's a limit to how far that can go. I honestly think they might be posed with the same problem here that Mario had after Mario 64, which is that there still really isn't another Mario game like Mario 64. Yeah. We'll see what Mario Odyssey is. And I think the one time they tried to brush up against Mario 64 is Mario Sunshine. And I know people love that. That game has a lot of great qualities.
Yeah,
I do think it is one of the... Qualities. It is one of the...
Also, you are right. It is a lot like Twilight Princess in that way. It has some good qualities and it has a lot of bad qualities.
I think it is one of the most compromised Mario games. And I think it's because what Mario 64 did is, to this day, so singular and different in the history of video games, it might just not be repeatable. And we'll see what Mario Odyssey does. But I think that's been an issue with Mario 64. The thing about Mario is that he is intensely malleable, and they could go in all these other directions, and so Mario has never suffered for that.
Yeah.
Zelda is not malleable in quite the same sense.
Yeah, it's like, because Zelda's so fixed to that sort of setting and tone and style, whereas, like, Mario can, like, he can go anywhere. He can go to Delfino Island. He can go to space. Like,
yeah.
He's just a fucking mascot character, whereas, like, Zelda... And Link and, like, that cast in that world is much, much more grounded, even if it's a fantasy setting. But, yeah, like, you can't have The Legend of Zelda in space. Like, I know that GDC, they sort of gave a presentation where they showed off some concept art about, like, crazy other directions they thought about going. But it's obvious you just can't do that. Like, at that point, it's not Legend of Zelda anymore.
Yeah. But, I mean, the transition from, like, if you skip Majora's Mask, from Ocarina of Time to, like, Wind Waker, I think if they did something like that where... I mean, hell, if it was an ocean, that might be fun, too. But, you know, where
it's like Zelda Pirates. Actually, that would, like, kind of, in a way, make good on Wind Waker in a way that, like...
The Legend of Zelda Black Flag?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Where Link is, like, he gets kicked out of Hyrule Castle and he decides to become a pirate.
Yes.
I mean, you know, if they find a way to sort of reinvent the... Not reinvent, but find a new way to make a world that's explorable and with new mechanics to explore the world, I think that would be equally as compelling in a lot of ways.
Cool. So what I'm hearing from you is you want The Legend of Zelda 3.
That is exactly what I just said.
Honestly, I think we need to think bigger than this. I think Nintendo itself has an issue of, not even a major bad issue, but there's a significant chance that the first game released for the Switch will be the best game for the Switch.
Yeah.
And that's a weird thing where, that doesn't have to be a bad thing, but it is a weird thing to think about of, like, just Nintendo as a whole, where do they go after this? And, so, and luckily they've got a Mario game coming up.
I'm curious to see if this sort of, like, revolutionary energy they have developed around around this game and saying, like, we're not just going to keep on making the Zelda games we did in the past, we're going to rethink this. I wonder if that's something that's, like, going to happen more broadly at Nintendo, or if it was more, because it's weird to think, keep in mind, like, how long this game has been in development for, about, like, has that sort of infected other parts of Nintendo, or is it going to be sort of go back to Nintendo as usual after this? I think a lot of it depends on what Super Mario Odyssey ends up being in, like, a broader sense.
Well, and there's a fascinating point. By the end of the Switch's first year, it will have the big Zelda game and the big Mario game. They will have hit number 1 and 2 on the list.
Yeah.
And
there
then
might
they
even
have
be the Smash Bros.
There might even be a new Smash Bros. So, like, because we don't know if the Smash Bros. They're developing is a port or if it's a new thing.
I mean,
so,
even if just you're talking ports too, it'll also have a good Mario Kart
on there. So the question to me is also, like, the Switch will have hit kind of the main buttons in year one, and then it's for the rest of its lifespan, what do they do? And I think it would be a time to look at their other franchises and have what you call that revolutionary energy. And if that carries over to Mario Odyssey, which from the trailers it totally could be, that game looks like it could be fucking insane.
Yeah.
You know, I think you're right. And, you know, we've had a little bit, I think Fire Emblem had some of that energy to it in the 3DS generation.
Yeah, with Awakening, if someone hasn't actually played that game, sounded like that. Yeah. Dude Around it was more like that.
And so that could come over. I think this would be a phenomenal chance to reinvent Pokemon. I think, you know, there's so many, we're always going to call for Metroid, but it's also a phenomenal chance for that.
It's never going to happen again. they just don't seem to care.
I think it, you know, Donkey Kong has been stuck for a couple games now in the Country Returns games, which are cool. But hey, we could do an actual
shit.
I didn't like that game either. We could do, you know, Donkey Kong 64 is the only, like, 3D Donkey Kong.
Yeah, Kong 65.
Let's do it. Well, anyway, let's go ahead and move on and talk about another of the greatest games ever made. Yeah. What Sean and I think is the greatest game ever made, right? Persona 3. Thomas, you played Persona 3. Recently.
I did.
Spoilers from this point out for Persona 3. If you have somehow made it 180 episodes into this podcast and not gotten the bug.
I wonder how many times we have just, like, accidentally spoiled Persona 3 on this podcast without even thinking about it, just with how much we talk about this goddamn game.
It's true. Thomas, I was thinking about where I wanted to start this conversation, because I want to focus on kind of the new perspective you bring to the table for this.
I bring a new perspective to the table.
Thank you.
But here's the thing. So Sean and I both played Persona 4 first.
Yes.
And it's an interesting thing where you could say that's a really valid way to introduce people to these games, because Persona 4, you haven't played it, but it eases you into what Persona is much better in some ways than Persona 3 does. Yeah,
especially Persona 4 the Golden.
Yeah. And Persona 3, in some ways, we've talked about this with, like, how it treats social links, like having a social link with an MMO person, feels like it plays with Persona conventions in a way where it sometimes feels like a sequel to Persona 3.
Yeah, or like, shit, like, you have a dog and a robot that summons personas. Feels like that's the thing the second game that team makes, you go to that. That's not the first time around that team makes a game. They're like, you know what would be crazy? Let's just have a dog summon a persona. Does that even make sense with the lore? It does now.
Yeah. So I guess my question is, we didn't have this experience, but you played Persona 3 first, which is how it came out. So. Yeah. And I think I have some sense of this, but, you know, your first 10, 20 hours with Persona 3, kind of easy. You definitely got to a point where I know you loved this game. But what was that like of, like, starting with Persona 3?
Well, first off, you recommended I start with Persona 4. And I said, I know Zelda and then Mass Effect are going to come out in, well, at the time I didn't know Mass Effect was coming out in March. But I know Zelda was coming out.
Nobody
in
did.
I probably will have time to play one game, and you've said that Persona 3 is the best game.
Yes.
You said not of Persona games, of any game.
Yes, that is just where that's where the period lands.
So I said, fuck your suggestion, I'm going to play Persona 3.
It's also easier to do that on an emulator, because you would have to have a Vita for 4 to play the Golden.
I was playing it on my PC with the emulator.
It's okay, that's how I played it also.
Yeah.
Did you? I mean, I actually bought the game. Did you actually buy the game?
Yeah, sure.
You damn pirate.
I have bought the game 3 times. It's okay, Thomas.
Sure, yeah. We can just say that we lent you our copies.
They've gotten a lot of my money. For the Persona 3 movies, I spent $80 times 4.
That is true.
I spent What is that, 320? Yeah. $320, that's more than the cost of the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, I bought the art books, I bought Persona 5 in Japanese, and I'm getting the fucking like $70 Persona 5 English version, yes. And I bought the soundtrack for Persona 5, so they've gotten my money too.
Yeah. It's okay, Thomas.
Well, anyway, Persona 3, it was interesting, I didn't get into it until about, maybe, I don't know, 15-ish hours in.
Yeah.
When I sort of really, because that game sort of, the beginning is... It's kind of hard for me to remember, I guess, but there's sort of a slow burn of it introducing the concepts, because for the first few hours, there are no shadows or any personas. Then there's that cutscene where the protagonist says persona and he uses the evoker for the first time. And it was like, awesome. It's like, oh, I want to do this for the rest of my life or whatever.
Yeah, I want to shoot myself in the head over and over and over again for the rest of my life.
To protect this girl.
Yes.
Who pointed the gun-looking thing at me when I first met her. Anyway... but then, like, after that, it's like the aspect of social links sort of starts off really slow, and in a way, I wish I would have really understood better at the beginning. Because
everyone who's ever played a Persona game thinks that.
I could have done so many more. No other game has that kind of mechanic. Like, it's so unique. Many more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gee, but by summer, I guess, which feels pretty early in the game, even though it's, I guess, in terms of days, it's a little less than half.
You start in April, so.
You start in spring, so.
Yeah, but by, like, the end of summer, I was absolutely hooked. I was playing it a lot more.
I mean, honestly, that is more or less the experience I had with the game as well. Like, I think I was a little bit more into it just because I had the on-ramp of Persona 4 already, but I did feel like... And part of it was the expectations of Persona 4, which has a very different sort of opening and a sense of pacing that, like, it took me a while to get, like, what is this game doing? And I think it is also part of the storytelling in Persona 3 is it's much more of a, like, building up this really grand narrative that and, like, building up these characters that at first don't necessarily pop as much as the Persona 4 cast because they are, like, way more sort of, like, in-your-face and kind of bubbly. And the Persona 3 characters are all kind of, like, they're dark and weird and they have, like, weird... dark backstories about, like, oh, my, you know, my dad's a drunk, and it's like, oh, my, I saw, like, my best friend and I saw this woman die. Like, they have shit that went on in their lives that, like, you slowly uncover over the course of the game, and at first, none of that is, like, immediately apparent to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of balance between the main story, which starts out kind of slow, and by the end is absolutely phenomenal, and all the smaller stories with the social links is really, it's really compelling, and... I think that's why it took me a little while to get into it, because, like, the first social link you have available is the classmate.
It's Kenji.
Kenji, who, yeah. He's a fucking weirdo.
That is for people, that is the social link where his whole thing is he is in love with his teacher and wants to start a relationship with his teacher, and this is the thing I love about the Persona 3 social links, because Persona 4 and Persona 5 do not do this, yeah. Is your social link with him is you getting him to try to have a relationship with his teacher. Like, the best way to advance through that social link is to push him further along this path of clear self-destruction.
If you say, hey, man, maybe you should... back off or try something else, he's like, man, I don't want to be your friend.
Yeah, so if you want to, and a lot of the social links in Persona 3 are kind of like that you need to tell the person what they want to hear, which I think is intentional, but it has a really weird effect where sometimes you're like, you as a player are watching this and be like, Kenji, you fucking idiot. Kenji's no. No, your teacher does not want to have sex with you. Stop, you are such a fucking creepazoid.
The other one you were thinking sports guy.
Sports guy, yeah.
What sport did you do?
I was the kendo club.
Kendo for life.
I did swim team.
Sure, that's what you do when you play a video game set in Japan.
I don't know.
I'm going to join the fucking swim team.
It was, the, I don't know.
It's the second. It's the second best. That's not the worst.
It's the same dude. He had a knee injury on the swim team. I was wondering
it's the same social link. No matter what.
Does he have a different injury or is it just?
I think it's a knee injury. Yeah. Knee injuries, that's debilitating. No matter what.
But it's like you have to be an enabler for that guy too. Because you have to be like, no, keep pushing yourself, ruin your body. But it's kind of it's for your little brother.
It's funny, Thomas, because. When you started playing the game, like, I was very careful not to tell you too much, even though I knew it would make the game hard for you at the start. And, like, because there's a lot of stuff that are just you kind of have to get used to, and I was kind of watching that process of you getting used to it, because I knew, if you're really going to love this game, I can't give it to you. I can't spoon-feed that. And I think I remember you being really confused by some of the Kenji and the sports team stuff early on. One, because social links are such a vastly different system than anything else any game has ever attempted.
Yeah.
And then two, because... like, the thematics of those early on are not quite as apparent why they go in that direction. I think there's a reason they go in that direction. But it is off, maybe off-putting in some ways at the very beginning.
Especially if you're coming from the direction we came at it with, like, Persona 4, which is the exact opposite. Like, in Persona 4, it's so much more about you being, like, the stand-up guy who's going to tell people, like, maybe what is the harder thing to hear, but is what the thing they need to hear. Yeah. And, like, that's how you need to play in Persona 4, because it's a very different sort of theme. And so when you go from that to Persona 3, you're like, why am I telling this dude to hook up with this teacher? This is such a fucking bad idea.
You also, you keep encouraging the gourmet, the fat guy, too, and he's part of a cult at the end, and you're like, whatever. Okay, that's fine.
God, that game has such amazing social links.
The social links.
It's awesome.
Because you really came around to loving the social
links. I did come. Well, I mean, you know, by the time you're doing, I mean, I guess at the end was absolutely amazing, obviously. Yeah. But Mitsuru and Yukari. Fuka and Yukari. I mean, those are just your party members. But what are some of the other really?
The
I mean,
old man. You love the old man.
Yeah, you. Not Yuko. Whatever they are.
It's been a while for so I can't remember.
The monk social link.
Oh, the monk guy. Yeah.
The I mean the two old couple in the
bookstore. Yeah.
The dying man at the shrine.
That's probably my favorite.
That one was amazing. Yeah. I like almost didn't finish that one.
The elementary school girl.
On the Sunday.
Oh yeah. That's the last one you did. Yeah. That's good.
The elementary school girl is great. The MMO.
The MMO one,
I said the wrong thing to her at the very end of the game, so I didn't get the good scene with her.
Oh, no!
Did you watch it on YouTube or anything?
No, I haven't gone back and watched it.
Okay, yeah, that might be one of my favorite social links in the whole franchise. Because there's just, it's so unique. There's something so amazing about you having a social link with someone that you, again, something that like feels like would have been iterated on as like a twist on the social link system is a social link with a person that you don't actually meet for the duration of that social link. And it's only until the very, very end of the game that if you have completed that social link, you find out who it was. Even though like you figure it out, but you never like encounter that person. And there's something about having that moment at the end where it's like, fine, this has been building up for me. It was like building up for literally the entire game.
Yeah.
It was like my favorite social link. I was waiting so hard. Like, I can't wait until I confront her that she is this lady I met on this MMO and she doesn't know who I am. And it was just like, I needed it so bad. It was so good.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about being sort of enablers with some of the characters or social links, you can't tell a girl that you want to just be friends.
Yeah.
If she's available to be a dating. And at first I was like, oh man, I kind of want to just be a good person and only date one girl.
You only think that once when you're playing the Persona games, then you let that go.
Yeah, I've learned that lesson. Because there are some really great scenes with all of them because you're in a relationship.
Yeah.
I'm like, I think you said you didn't finish Mitsuru's.
No, because Mitsuru's is fucking hard to finish.
Yeah, because it sure opens up so late, it's pretty hard.
I got it, fine.
No, I'm kind of in awe.
It's just like it just depends on like the order of how you tackle them. So
right,
like
if
you're deep into other social links when hers opens up and you prioritize those, you're just never going to finish hers.
Yeah. But I mean there's an amazing scene with her, probably like 8 or 9 of 10, that is only because you're dating, obviously. So
right.
Yeah, it's for those ones like the ones that are romance options, because in later in Persona 4 and onward, like you can choose one of the other paths, but it is always just pick the one that's the romance option, because literally how it works in those games is you just get more dialogue. Like they are the same scenes, but they just kind of like cut off at the end if you just became friends. Whereas like if you do the romance option, it just keeps on going down. It's like that's the, like you have to sort of like remove from your mind how this would actually be working for these characters and this weird.
Oh, not in Persona 4. It
not
totally
Persona
works. 4.
In Persona 3 and Persona 5, the main characters do not seem like people who would have, like, six different girlfriends. But you have to just be like, that's, like, these different, like, side stories. Other than, in, like, there's a fun scene in Persona 5 if you're, you know, a bit of a philanderer where it has fun with that. But other than those, like, they're just off in their own, like, weird universes.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, and you always pick your, like, canonical girlfriend, right?
Sure.
Like, you know, isn't the one you spend Christmas on and then move on.
No, there's not a canonical girlfriend in that, like, the other media, like the movies and stuff, don't ever double down on a romance option. I always
a canonical name.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say that they hint at where the deepest relationships seem,
like,
but that's an interpretive thing.
Well, I mean, obviously, Yukari is the lovers.
Yeah. That is the... Have you played... Because you played, I presume, the Persona 3 Fest version emulated. Have you played the answer part of it yet? You should. It's good.
I will get around to that eventually.
Yeah.
But I think you also had... You were thinking you might just play it when you were done, and I think you had the same reaction I did, which is like, I need a break.
Yeah.
Yeah, that,
I waited a couple of months until I tackled it.
Yeah. I might play Persona 4 before I do that. Even.
God, it's so funny. Every time he would ask me about the answer, I would want to call it Episode Igus.
Because it's such a good name. It's such a good name.
And I had to stop myself because I'm like, that's a spoiler, kind of. You could assume like what happens at the end of Persona 3 if I told you the follow-up is called Episode Igus.
Yeah.
So I always said, yeah, it's the answer, even though I never think of it that way. It is Episode Igus in my head.
Episode Igus and Episode Yourself is the best.
He was telling me that earlier. Oh. That's awesome. Speaking of interesting social links, there's also Elizabeth.
Yes. Who, yeah.
You know,
not technically a social link.
Not
but,
technically a social
but,
link,
but operates similarly.
Yeah, yeah, especially the last one. That was interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, one of the most interesting things I found, especially regarding Igus, I think, is that Persona 3. I haven't made a list, but it'd probably be in my top 10 games. And then Mass Effect as a whole is also one of my favorite games or franchises or whatever.
You are in equal company here.
Yes. Yeah, but specifically like Mass Effect 2, which I like Mass Effect 3 a little more for a couple reasons, but I recognize that Mass Effect 2 is probably a better game overall. That and Persona 3 deal with a lot of sort of similar concepts regarding death and loss and the humanity of machines. I found that really fascinating, especially the way they approach it with Igus, that for most of the game, it tells you whenever you talk to her, if she were more human-like, you could probably engage with her a little more or something. And the way that sort of finally becomes apparent when she comes back in, I guess, late December, and she's encouraging you to kill Ryoji because she wants, you know, the party to not have to suffer. But then she comes around to wanting to be part of the group that wants to keep pushing forward and be... That's a very sort of human thing. It's illogical to want to suffer until you die. But she decides that's what she wants to do as well.
Yeah, she wants, like, these memories and experiences she's had with these people to sort of survive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this is something we said when we did our retrospective on Persona 3 back many episodes ago. That was in the 60s, I think.
Yeah.
And
you mean the 1960s, obviously.
Pretty much at this point.
When did the game come out? Was it
2007. 2007. 2006 and 2007 were the fast
release. It was 07. Yeah. That's crazy that was an 07 game.
We're just thinking about PS2. This is 2017, so it's the 10th anniversary of all the 2007 games, of which there are. That was one of those pile up years, infamously.
Yeah. That Mass
Halo
Effect.
3, Mass Halo Effect, 3, Call of Duty 4.
Yeah, Super Mario Galaxy.
Bioshock.
Yeah,
jeez,
not so year. Anyway, but what we were saying when we talked about this a long time ago, Sean, is that Persona 3, in our opinion, asks the biggest questions human beings can reasonably ask that have actual, like, not answers, but things we can work through.
Yeah.
Not like, where did all this come from?
Yeah, that's, like, why are we here?
That's
like,
That's a different question that, one, means something different to absolutely everybody you ask it to, and is kind of meaningless in its just utter... the possibilities for it.
Yeah.
But this is asking, you know, what is the... not why are we here, but what's the value of life? What does it mean to live? What does it mean to die? And then it tackles those questions with such pinpoint precision is what makes the game so wonderful. And I think that's what you're talking about with the Igus thing, of that, you know, she comes back in December and she has that gradual revelation. It's, yes, on the surface, analytically, you would think that the protagonist would want to kill Ryoji and not have to suffer through this. But that's not human. That's not living.
Also... Ryoji was my friend.
Yeah. He's got a dope scarf.
He does have that dope scarf.
You haven't seen the movies yet, Thomas, but they do such a great job with Ryoji in the films.
Yeah.
Especially the third film is the one he's in, and when he's got that dope scarf, looks even better, fully animated.
He does do the asshole thing in the spa, though.
Well, sure.
He's like, dude, just let's fucking leave.
Yeah.
I figured out he was Pharos, though, like the first day he was there.
Yeah, he's the same voice actor, so...
Not that hard. I didn't think about that, but it's also like Pharos says, "I'll never see you again. I'm disappearing," and then it's like, "Oh, there's this kid who has the same haircut."
Right? Yeah, it's a very like anime thing to do of like disappearing, and then like the next episode, a new character shows up and says, "Yeah, okay, I figured out who you are."
But they kill him like six times in the end.
I was interested to see when you like predicted things, Thomas, and got, you know, because Persona 3 is to me a great example of, I hate the thing in criticism where people are like, oh, the story was predictable, that means it's bad.
Yeah.
Fuck off. That means the story was generally, that means it was well written.
Dude, like, welcome to fucking Greek tragedy, assholes. Like, you're just defying, like, thousands of years of human storytelling.
There are very few things in Persona 3 narratively that I would define as surprising in terms of narrative mechanics. surprising things like the whole scene in the love hotel or something like
sure.
that.
Different yeah, but like surprise. The things of like the twists of like Ikskeet or whatever his name is betraying you, Ikskeet. Like that's like a twist, quote unquote, in terms of like what is literally happening in the plot. But it's so heavily telegraphed to the player before that actually happens. That yeah. or like with the Ryoji stuff, it's clear that like. That's not supposed to be a massive surprise to the player, viewer, like whoever, that that is like that character's identity. But the way that it is constructed within the plot and the way you care about the characters means that when it happens to them and they are revealed, like this information is revealed to them, it hurts and shocks them. And that's where the effect comes from, is yeah. the pathos for the character. And that's, again, like in a lot of ways, Persona 3 operates on like a Greek tragedy thing, which is also all the personas of the main characters are named after Greek figures and goddesses and stuff, so it's clearly apparent that they knew that that was their influence. Like your main character's persona is fucking Orpheus, you know, yeah. who's the son of Apollo. So that like structure is very intentional in Persona 3, and it's for me it's one of my favorite modes of storytelling, because I think when you have that, when the audience has that knowledge ahead of time, then from the characters, it creates this situation of like dread and anticipation that you want. And that's really powerful in a way that just like doing the like cliche Shyamalan style twists can be cool, you know, like the end of Unusual Suspects or something is cool the first time you see it, but it's like, and once that trick, once that card is played, there's no real value in it anymore to the viewer.
You know, yeah. I've always said this, I don't think there's such a thing as a story that can be ruined, a good story that can be ruined by a spoiler.
Yeah.
Because if it's a good story, it cannot be ruined. By a spoiler. If it can be ruined by a spoiler, it's not a good story. It's an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Exactly.
You know, and The Usual Suspects is something that holds up, even if you know who Kaiser Soze is, because it's a good movie.
Yeah, it's good filmmaking. But yeah.
So, you know, I think Persona 3 is that, where it's also, what I was getting at is, it's pretty easy to figure out that this game has to end with the protagonist dying.
Yeah.
In some ways. That by the time you get there, that feels like it has to happen. And it so doesn't matter that that's not a shock. The emotions of that are utterly overwhelming, and it's because it's good, solid, wonderful storytelling and character development and thematic development.
That was, I mean, that's really, I think a lot of things are more predictable in hindsight than, you know, like, nothing's really surprising, like, Pharaoh's eventually being death. He was the Death Arcana, and that happened, no matter what you did, that had to happen. So it's, you know, it's kind of predictable, but, like, to me, I figured out that the protagonist was probably going to die. I think I texted you this at one point. I said, I think either I'm going to die or we're all going to die. And then that was before Ryoji said, you're all going to die.
Yeah.
At which point I thought, well, probably are all going to die.
Once you figure out it's a game about death.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once you like start drawing the lines, it's like, okay, yeah, well, this social link ultimately was kind of about death. And this character's story arc was ultimately kind of about death. And this character, I see what they're doing.
A lot of the social links are either about death or acceptance or both. Like the old couple, you know, their son is dead, and they ultimately come to the term that the persimmon tree, that they're okay with it being cut down because it means a brighter future for youth, which is what their son would have wanted. Or there's the young man who dies, who gives you the story at the end, which made me cry when he tells you the end of that story.
Man.
Or there's even like the little kid whose parents are getting divorced. That's still sort of about acceptance and loss and change. And then, but because I had figured that out sort of before January happened, I think I texted you this. I drew out January for as long as I could.
Yeah, I know you did.
I found the secret dungeon. I leveled up to level 99. I didn't want to finish the game because I knew I was going to die. But, like, eventually I was like, I'm ready to finish the game. Partly because I made it to the max level. Partly because it was like, I've finished all the social links finally. And, I mean,
And that is why Persona 3 is the greatest game ever. Because the themes that you're describing and the gameplay mechanics you're describing, one does not exist without the other. You get the feeling you get out of the end of that game because it is a game and you experiencing it, and like David Tennant at the end of Doctor Who, you don't want to go.
Yeah.
You know, and you viscerally feel that. You are not told that. You don't see that in another character. You feel it.
Yeah, I don't think there's been another moment in the game where like my heart has just sort of like sunk into my chest than when in that last boss fight, like the very, very end when you cast the spell, and the spell is the exact number of your HP, and that's the moment where you know 100% for sure that's like, this is it. Like, no matter what happens past this point in this game, like, even if he lingers on for a little bit, like, this is it. I'm literally spending my life to cast this spell, and that's just like, even again, you know that it's coming, and it's precisely because you know that it's coming that when you see that, and you, that moment is there for sure, and you have to fucking press that button to do that, it's like, God damn it, I don't want to have to do this.
Yeah. That's interesting. I would say this game does it better than Mass Effect does it. Mass Effect spoilers, by the way. At the end of Mass Effect 3, you die. Unless you choose, well, you know, whatever.
You die.
You die. But that's another thing. That's another thing I did. I think I was more into the story of Mass Effect than a lot of people. I think the time I played it, I found it. It was sort of right around the time when we knew Dad was going to die.
Yeah.
The next time I played it, it was right after my girlfriend broke up with me. And I was going to college. It was like a major change in my life. Like, the amount of time I lingered at the very end of Mass Effect 3 felt kind of the same way. I think Persona 3 probably did it in a stronger way, at least the ending of that. Sort of the themes of accepting your own death. I mean, it's just really amazing how games can do that, though.
Yeah.
I definitely... You said that about drawing a line between Mass Effect 3 and Persona 3, and there's actually... For us, there's that thing of Mass Effect was the thing you got into right after Dad died, and for me, it was Persona 4 and 3. So it has a moment in my life that it helped me actually work through that in a way nothing else in my life could. But I actually do very much draw a line between Mass Effect 3 and Persona 3. I think they are very thematically similar, and to me, you leave me with a very similar feeling. And, you know, Persona 3 is kind of like its own trilogy, because if you add up all the Mass Effect games, they roughly are as long as a Persona 3, right?
Sure, yeah.
The way I played them, they're shorter.
They're shorter, yes. No, but like, you know, Mass Effect 3 is in its totality is an ending, kind of like January is a totality of an ending for Persona.
And I maybe spent about as long in January as a typical Mass Effect 3 playthrough.
Yeah. And, you know, you get to the end of Mass Effect 3, and to me, I think where that... And it's something we've said before about the ending of Mass Effect 3 is... The sin Mass Effect 3 committed for the gaming public is that it's cerebral.
Yeah.
That it's a philosophical ending, it's an intellectual ending, it asks you to fill in so many emotions and thoughts, and it probes these questions that are so much bigger than 99% of AAA American games even go near.
Yeah.
And, you know, it shares much more in common with a JRPG like Persona 3 than it does most American games. And so I actually think that line between those games is, to me, very tight. Between them.
I
feel the same way, because also I played Mass Effect 3 about a year before I would have played Persona 3, so they were like in close proximity for sure. And Mass Effect 3 was an interesting one for me, because that was also, that came out when I was a freshman in college, and so playing that, like, and like Mass Effect 1 came out when I was a freshman in high school, so there's like something about that of like this closing chapter of that, of like my high school life. And, like, saying goodbye to all those characters had, like, such a strong emotional impact on me. And then I turned around immediately, and then I played another game completely about death. And I don't know how to explain that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, because that would have been... You played Persona 4 at the end of 2012. Mass Effect 3 was the beginning of 2012. Because this is the whole story of our podcast. One of the last episodes of the monthly stuff, or one of our old shows outside of this numbering scheme, was you playing Mass Effect over a weekend.
Yeah, I played all of Mass Effect 3 over a weekend of going home, like mid, like going like back to my house, because I didn't have my Xbox at my dorm room. And so basically I finished classes Friday afternoon, went back home, got Mass Effect 3, and then played Mass Effect 3 from that Friday afternoon to like 3 in the morning on Sunday.
Nice.
And then like, and finished, like I literally, I remember I finished the game, because it would have been later than 3 in the morning, because I finished the game right when the sun started rising. And I was like, I have to go back to college to go to classes now in 2 hours.
Yep. And I finished Persona 3 with the sun rising.
Yeah.
I've told that story before on the
podcast.
That's
how I finished Persona 5 as well.
Yeah.
That's how you know it's a great video game, when like you had got close enough to the end where you can't stop it. You can't go, I can't leave this game undone for 5 fucking days until I can come back here where my Xbox is to finish this game. Like, I need to finish it now, and fuck it. If it's going to be 4 in the morning when I finish it, it's going to be 4 in the morning when I finish it.
Yeah. Well, I actually want to transition into talking about Mass Effect a little bit. Okay. Do we have anything else we want to say about Persona 3?
Best turn-based RPG I've ever played.
I want to hear some of your thoughts about stuff like the combat system. And this is a little bit different because you haven't played the other Persona games.
I also haven't played many JRPGs.
Yeah, so like one of the things that is very controversial about the original Persona 3 and FES, and one of the reasons why a lot of people prefer Persona 3 Portable, is that... In Persona 3 and Persona 3 Fest, as you well know, you do not have direct control over any of your party members, yeah. which is very unusual for a JRPG. And I can't think of another JRPG that has a turn-based combat system that yeah. does that. And
it's only like things like a Final Fantasy 13 that are like alt systems, you know?
Yeah, which are not mm-hmm. a normal turn-based right. combat system. Like, this is like a Final Fantasy style, like classic Final Fantasy style turn-based combat system. And for me, stuff like you not being able to directly control your party members and not being able to just equip things on them from a menu. You have to go talk to them yeah. and say, hey, put this spiked bra on, Mitsumitsu, and because that's the kind of guy I am.
Did you ever get the main outfit?
Yes, I did. Yeah. It's pretty good. But yeah, so like that stuff I thought was really interesting and clever in how it sort of like made the characters very distinct from the player character. Did you have any issues with the turn-based stuff?
I mean, every once in a while it was like Mitsuru would cast...
Marin Karin.
Yeah, and it was like, what the fuck are you doing? It's never going to work. It's going to work once in like the 300 battles or something we're going to do. But for the most part, I actually found it to be on like a role-playing level pretty engaging.
Yeah.
Because it was like, I would pick members of my party, you know, eventually I sort of settled on three, based more on sort of, you know, in some part sort of what they could do, but other than that, mostly just... You know, based on who they were and who
what was your,
to have with me.
What was your go-to team?
So in the end, it was Yukari, Mitsuru, and Aigis.
That's the exact team. Right team configuration.
Before that, I had Yukari, Mitsuru, or Yukari, Aigis, and the dog.
Okay,
I liked having the dog with me.
Yeah.
But I
wanted to hold on to the dog for a long time, but he had so many. Well, he has like dark spells and fire spells.
Yeah, he's the
like,
dark spells, and
the Mudo stuff's just not that good in Persona 3.
And it's easy to have strong fire spells too.
Yeah,
it's quit using the dark moves. But sometimes it was annoying, but usually I could get by with the tactics or whatever it was.
Yeah,
just sort of telling Yukari to heal or whatever, and usually I just told Mitsuru to not act freely, and that sort of fixed it. Yeah.
Yeah,
I guess was done. So okay, sometimes they said there's nothing they could do, like, so they had to wait, and it was like there's absolutely something you could have done.
Well, there's no way to get a system like that perfect, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I agree with what you guys are saying. It adds to this feeling of role playing where it's like Aigis isn't someone you're controlling; she's Aigis.
Yeah,
yeah. Like even if it is simplistic, they have. I mean, the fact that, like, you know, you can say that, like, Mitsuru always casts, like, Marin Karin, like, she casts that thing, it's annoying, or it's like, you know, Karamaru casts Mudo, and he's like, I don't want you to cast Mudo now. It's like, it is kind of annoying sometimes, but also, like, all those characters have their weird quirks that, like, that we can both identify as, like, something that, like, when I think of Mitsuru, that's one of the things I think about with her, is, like, her behaviors in combat, and, like, how that worked around those spells, and there's something really fascinating about that. And I think for usability's sake and the way that they sort of changed the combat system in Persona 4 and especially Persona 5, you want full control over your party members. But there's a part of me that does want them to go back to that system and like make it more complicated and fill it out again. And because they also have this weird vestigial quality to it where you can technically do the tactics thing in Persona 3 or in Persona 4 and 5. There's that menu option, but you never want to because as soon as that genie, that bottle is opened up, and you give me like the option to do direct command, it feels insane to let them just do whatever they want.
The other thing they limit, so Thomas, to tell you, the Persona 4 combat system, I assume Persona 5 is similar, is you can either have them do the Persona 3 thing where they act on their own, and you have a menu of tactics, but it's only four options, not like the 8 or 9 you get in Persona 3.
As you go through.
Yeah, and so you have that, or you can just control them directly. And of course, in Persona 4 and 5, you're really supposed to control them directly.
Yeah, like especially in Persona 5, some of the combat encounters are so complicated with like the different element things that you can do and the different abilities you get for your player. I don't want to spoil what they are, but like you can't. In my mind, the sheer idea of trying to play that game using those tactics is like, I don't even know how you would do that. Like, that seems insane.
Yeah. So, like, you know, and I think that does work and is essential for how Persona 4 and I assume 5 is built. Like, the way the dungeons are changed in Persona 4 from 3 and the way the pace changes a little bit, you want to have direct control for a number of reasons. What they did in Persona 3 Portable is they brought that system into Persona 3. And the problem with that is that you can just leave them fighting on their own. But you only get those limited tactics, not the full suite. So if you want to do that, it breaks the game at a certain point where it's really hard to do and there's a lot of issues with it. And there's a pace in Persona 3, the way the dungeons are built, that they're a little more grindy, and I say that in a good way in this sense. They're, you know, they're a little more maze-like, and there's just so much of it because you have this one tower to climb up. That constant pace of, like, the battles go by a little faster because everyone's controlling themselves and everything, I think it really works in Persona 3. If you took that and put it in Persona 4 the exact same way, I think there would be a little incongruity there. Mm-hmm. But that works the other way around, too, where when they put that in Portable, that makes the dungeon side of Portable, to me, a lot less enjoyable. Yeah, but you got really into the dungeon stuff, I know.
I did. Well, okay, first off, the problem I did have with combat in general was that the characters not in your party didn't level up with you.
Yeah, so Persona 5 fixes that.
So Persona 4 doesn't, though?
No, yeah, it's like, annoying.
By the end, if I wanted to use Akihiko, I think he was level 20 or something.
Yeah.
I was like, I mean, I'm sorry, you're never going to be in the party. Also, did you ever put the kid in your party?
Ken, no. No.
You ever put him in once?
I think to see what he was like, okay. But not to...
I was like, I'm not going to fight with a kid.
Yeah, he's like 12 years old.
I'm not going to endanger this kid. I don't even like the kid. He tried to kill, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that ultimately wasn't a really good scene, but...
Watch the movies. You'll like Ken.
They do him much. Because also the voice actor in Japanese, I think, is better.
Yeah.
But also, anyway, for the dungeons, did you, Sean, find the secret dungeon?
No, not for Persona 3. If I played it now, even if I had played it for the first time now, I definitely would because, you know, I played Persona 3 in Japanese and I got to level 99 and maxed out all my social links. So I'm definitely at this point with Persona games. It is I'm fucking getting everything in this game or it's nothing.
Well, it was much easier to level up fast in the secret dungeon at the end. Because basically in January you get the request from Elizabeth to kill the Reaper or to kill Death.
Yeah.
And when you do that, then there's a big door that opens up at the back of Tartarus, and it's like this 10-level sort of mini dungeon, but every monster in there is level 85 plus.
Wow.
Yeah. So the fact that you like the combat stuff in Persona 3 so much is another reason why you should probably play the answer, because one of the things that's cool about that, and it's something that I enjoyed the combat in Persona 3, but I didn't love it until I played the answer, and like in that... it's not like the combat is brutally difficult, but they push the difficulty level up higher than normal, and like some of the enemy configurations are pretty fucking devious with how the weaknesses and like reflections and stuff work together. So I think you would like it a lot.
Yeah, because it's like all combat.
Yeah, it's a lot more like the ratio is a lot heavier on combat than story than the main game.
Well, there aren't any social links, are there?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, I'll play it someday. Have you played it, Jonathan?
Never to completion.
Okay.
I will.
Well, then...
I mean, it's a black mark on him. We don't like to talk about it on the podcast.
Shame.
One last thing about Persona 3. Because you're a music guy, we have to talk about the music.
Okay, actually, I did want to talk about that. The song that plays, I guess, before you get to the menu, when you're loading up the game, and also over the credits, is really amazing, and I wish they would have put subtitles for it so I could understand what they were saying.
Yeah.
Because I had to look it up, and then I started like crying when I was listening to it.
Yeah, they're really good.
We've had that discussion on here.
So there's the one line that's in English, and you're like, that's interesting. And then
that's how Japanese music works. You always have the one line in English.
Then you go and look up the rest of them, and it's like, oh, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, Thomas is a composer by trade.
I composed the Weekly Stuff theme song that's never used.
Well, it's on YouTube, but I haven't done a YouTube version of this in a while because my internet connection is too slow to upload videos.
You should get faster internet.
For those who's wondering, it literally became, I couldn't do it. It would crash every time.
Nice.
YouTube wouldn't save it. It was weird. Anyway, if I can get a better way to do it, I will.
Anyway, music guy. What did you want to ask?
It's just like, you know, how did you... What are your takeaways of that soundtrack? Like, what were your favorite sort of bits of it and stuff
baby,
like that?
Baby, baby, baby.
Yes, yes.
I like the music. I didn't like it at first. I wasn't in love with it at first. I was pretty neutral on it. By the end, I really loved it. Especially in January when all the music changes. Yeah.
That
was
and really it's strong. All like sort of different instrumental versions of the end credits song.
Yeah. Well, it's also, they all incorporate elements, sort of motifs from the various areas you're in. And it sort of reflects the change of attitude you have when you know, when you're faced with the end and when you're faced with, I think you said on the soundtrack, they're all called memories of this place.
Yeah, like memories of school, memories of the city.
Yeah, it's actually really smart musically how they do a lot of that. Just, I mean, it's fairly simple the way they do it, just incorporating different thematic elements that are pretty subtle, but they evoke a certain, or they help to evoke at least certain emotional responses when you're listening to them and when you're walking around at school or in the mall, or especially in the dorm, actually, I thought was the most well done one at the end.
One where they reuse they rework the sad social link theme, right? Yeah. Living with the Termination.
Yeah. But I mean, other than that, the music's all just kind of fun. And there's, you know, it's still meaningful so and it works with the game. But yeah, at first I was like, gosh, Jonathan likes to play this stuff in the car sometimes.
It's, so yeah, I guess that's true because you were exposed to it before you had played the game, which is something that didn't happen with us.
So yeah, it's like, and it's like, you know, I'm not really a jazz guy anyway, and it's like, this is fun, but just stop playing it already. But I totally understand why you love it so much now.
And I know you're, it'd be different from different thoughts on this. I don't mind, I don't think I do, Sean, either, when a game has a relatively limited song set, even if it goes over like 80, 90 hours. Yeah. I'm fine listening to the same stuff over and over again. I know, Thomas, you sometimes criticize, I know you thought of this with The Witcher 3, for instance, and Breath of the Wild a little bit, that you sometimes wish they had a little more music.
It's not a criticism I have, it's just a wish I have. Like, okay. It's not a negative mark for the game, it would just be more positive sometimes, like with The Witcher 3, if there was a little more music in it. A little more variety sometimes.
Yeah.
That's something I think Skyrim has probably done the best because
it feels, you know, like
it has music. Like 5 hours. I mean, Final Fantasy 15 actually. That's probably, for me, that's the strongest mark for Final Fantasy 15 is that there are 6 hours of music in the game, and it, you use all of that throughout it.
And other than the chocobo piece, it doesn't feel repetitive ever.
but you don't mind it when it's the chocobo
piece. No, I love it.
It's more with the chocobo piece in that game. It's just more that it's frustrating that once you start riding chocobos, you never hear any of the other music in the fucking game because it overrides all the other music in the open world.
Unless you're trying to level up your damn survival skill.
Yeah, you give up on that at some point.
No, you rubber band your controller and platinum it. That's actually what I did.
It's very frustrating on Xbox to do that because you have to check on it every 10 minutes and like reset yourself a little because
you're running and
aiming the camera straight up or something.
Because Xbox is different. Yeah, it's easier on PS4. And I didn't even have a rubber band. I had a hair tie that I had to figure out.
Yeah, and for me, I think one of the reasons why for all the Persona games, I've never really had that phenomenon. Like, I agree with you for The Witcher 3. There are moments of like, when you're spending a lot of time in, like, Velen or something.
Velen was the biggest one.
Because Velen's the largest area in that game, and there's, like, maybe, like, 3 or 4 tracks that play in different spots of Velen.
I never got, like, tired of them, per se, but I got to a point where it was like, I kind of wish there was something else for me to listen to.
The thing, one of the main differences for me is that there's such a sort of poppy quality to a lot of the music in Persona 3 and 4 and 5, especially, like, in the songs that play, like, every single day. You know, they have that kind of, like, pop song quality, like I could just listen to this forever. Like it just it just feeds into my subconscious.
It is one of the things I'll say. Persona 3 is one of my favorite video game soundtracks. I like it even more than it's one of the reasons I prefer 3 to 4, even though I love the 4 soundtrack. But I can put on the Persona 3 soundtrack just listening straight through, and I can do the whole thing. And I have done that many times in my life.
It's just like, you know, I will never get tired of the never felt like burr burr burr. Like I could just listen to that for the rest of my life, and I would be kind of satisfied.
Yeah, I mean, so an interesting thing that happened when I was playing was there were two pieces in particular. The main sort of battle one.
Mass Destruction?
Yeah, the one that starts with Baby like 7 times. And the one, I think it's the dorm piece for a while.
Yeah.
When it's the trumpet goes, ba-ba-da-da-da-da. And then it's the guy speaking and I think English.
Yeah, like it's completely incomprehensible. It's definitely
incomprehensible. And at first I was like, this is kind of weird and annoying. But then eventually I was like,
to the dance. That's like the one part of it I can make out the lyrics.
Well, I was like kind of like, so I was like sitting there
in a trance.
Yeah. I was like mouthing along with it after I got like tired of it. And I was like, I guess I actually really like this.
Yeah, you do. Because really Lotus Juice is a god among men.
It's such.
I love Lotus Juice.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's so great.
I mean, that's how I guess in general, even the music that got repetitive, like at first it was like, oh, there's been a lot of this, and then it was like, oh, I kind of love it though.
Yeah.
So.
God, and you haven't even heard like the other Persona 3 songs that aren't in Persona 3 that like have been done afterwards where they've brought Lotus Juice back and he's done more full songs. That dude can fucking rap.
Lotus Juice, he's the rapper guy?
Yeah.
What language is he speaking?
It's English.
English. He's a very fluent English speaker because he grew up in parts of America, but it's like part of those songs are, Yeah,
I can actually.
Some of those lyrics are insane.
In the songs outside of the game, I can understand everything he says.
His song, "The Midsummer Night's Dream," "Fate Is in Our Hands." The main theme for that, the second movie, is really good.
Or the version of "Deep Breath, Deep Breath" on the arrangement album.
Deep breath, deep breath.
Oh, that one.
On a Sunday morning, I touch the sky. Next morning, I touch your heart. What's the start?
What's also amazing about that song is that it has basically nothing to do with the version of the song that is in the game.
Yep.
Because that's like that really heavy sort of like techno song that plays in one of the early
dungeon
sections.
I'm going to need the soundtrack for this
game. Oh, I've got you covered.
We've got so much. It's obscene how much music we have for these games.
Yeah.
Because it's all so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, I... Yeah, the music in these fucking games. Persona 3, I just... Like, the song Joy, which plays during all the social links, that is the song of my soul. It's like, I want it played at my funeral. It's just such a beautiful fucking happy song to me. I cannot be sad listening to that song.
Speaking of being sad, I was a little sad of the after-school, or I guess during school and after-school song. It switches after summer.
Yeah,
or
changing seasons.
Yeah.
I liked the first one better. I liked that one better.
Funny. I'm the other way, mostly because there's something about the opening part of Changing Seasons where it's building up that I just found it so fun to just spin the camera, because the camera turn speed is at like the exact right speed for like the tempo of the song.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and then when the song starts, like that part goes on, it's like, okay, now I can go run and have fun on my day.
Yeah, I have wasted hours playing with the thumbsticks, dancing to the music.
Okay, I did do that in the dorm with the song we were talking about earlier.
Yes.
Where I would just walk nowhere.
The music's really good.
I had a lot of fun running in circles, I guess.
There's, like, and you guys saying which one you prefer, I love every Persona 3 song just about equally. I just, they're so good.
Also, I discovered this, I think I told you this, like, when I was playing in January, I discovered that Fuka had the radio function, or the MP3 player, in January.
Yeah.
Now we're like on this death mission. I'm going to listen to all this like rock and roll while we're exploring.
Yeah, because they're all remixes of songs from the Persona 1 and 2 games.
Okay.
Which is something that like it's weird that's like kind of the strongest connection that the Persona 3 game like series has with what came before, because after Persona 2 the team switched to what then Persona 3, 4 and 5 are all made by the same team. Yeah. And there's something kind of crazy now that I have gone back and played Persona 1 and the 2s. And now, like, Maya's theme song from Persona 2 is one of my favorite Persona songs, and that's in... It's one of the songs you can play. There's remix of it in Persona 3.
Okay.
It was, like, weird coming at it from that whole other angle of, like, oh, that's where that song came from.
Yeah. That's cool. That's really cool. I love it when they do.
Well, so, are you sufficiently excited for Persona 5?
Okay. I don't have a PS4.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of liberating in a way, because it means I can finish college, I can graduate... And then maybe I can worry about Persona 5. Because in the meantime, I've got to play Mass Effect.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I could play Persona 4 if I run out of stuff to do.
Sure.
So, yes, I'm excited about it, but I'm not nearly as almost woefully anticipatory as you are.
Yeah. Well, so, I have the thing of I have to talk to this guy every week who's already played it.
And I have the thing where I have to talk to you assholes who can't even play it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's soon. It's so soon. So, we have to talk about video game priorities now for our last topic today.
Okay.
Which is...
This has been a stressful year for people.
Look, I have a list that is already like 10 titles deep of games I still need to play.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane. Like, just from the start of this year. And so right now we have Breath of the Wild just came out. You just played Horizon Zero Dawn, Sean.
Yeah.
I had to play Breath of the Wild and not Horizon. You're gonna play Zelda.
Yes.
Mass Effect's coming out on Tuesday.
Coming out, for me, I get to play it on Thursday.
The EA Access thing.
Yeah. It's coming out a week from Tuesday, I should say. Or a week from today when you're hearing this. Yeah, so you get to play a little early with the EA Access. And then Persona 5 is coming out right at the beginning of April. No one can possibly play all of these games at once, basically. No.
Plus, on top of that, for me, like, I never ended up playing Nioh, which like I want to get back around to that, because it's insane to me that I had as much fun with the alpha and beta of that game, and I have not fucking played the full game. That Nier Automata came out, which is a Platinum Games game, which has got such good reviews. That also has a fantastic demo, and I want to play that. It's like, I need to fucking play Zelda, and then Persona 5 is coming out. I want to play Resident Evil 7 at some point. I'm probably going to wait till there'll have to be a Halloween sale for that game.
That's a shorter game, though, right?
Yes, you
can play it a bunch of times.
That's like my thing is with like the candy of it. It's like, oh my god, there's a game I want to play that is only like 7 hours long, because every single game, the shortest game I've played this year is Horizon, or maybe like Gravity Rush 2. Both of those I spent like 30 hours on each.
Yeah, I've still got Horizon. I've got Horizon Zero Dawn. I've got Yakuza 0.
Yakuza Kiwami fucking comes out this summer.
Yep.
Jesus Christ.
Nier Automata I want to do. I want to do Resident Evil 7. And there's one I kind of learned about the other day, a JRPG that got brought over here, Tales of Berseria, the new Tales game, which is, I've heard about it, and it's like, it sounds like, I've never played one of those, but this is like a radically different one, and it sounds so cool. There's no way I'm not going to play that, because I've got a PS4, it's an exclusive, and there's just all these fucking games.
You have Kingdom Hearts HD 2.8 Final Chapter Prologue.
That's on my game schedule for releases.
Oh, okay.
It's when we never did the episode, but it was for the game.
Did that come out?
Yeah. It's for the game.
Yes, I think isn't now every single Kingdom Hearts game, I believe, is playable on PS4. Even like the weird handheld.
They're going to be end of March.
Okay. Yeah, because they haven't come out with HD plus 1.2 plus whatever.
That's not out yet.
Oh, the one that is that adds up to fucking Kingdom Hearts 4, the 2.5 plus 1.5. Yeah, it's like you guys you can't put that on that box. That's an insane thing. Kingdom Hearts 3 isn't out yet, assholes.
Yeah,
learn how edition works.
Thomas is also seeing the schedule I put together for the game preview episode. We didn't do this year because we were too busy playing games.
Playing the games that already came out in January.
So, like, my only hope is that I have time over the summer, but the biggest of these games is Mass Effect Andromeda, and much as I love Mass Effect, I don't think I'm going to have... Just because I think if I start March 21st, I don't think I'll be done with it by Persona 5.
Persona 5, no.
And then Persona 5 is going to be April for me.
Yeah, that's, like, all-consuming.
So I just have to hope that there's room over the summer for all these other games, including fucking Mass Effect. But it's just, they all, just everyone in gaming decided to go insane and release everything at the same time.
Like, what's crazy is that, because 2016 also already had that effect. Like, it felt like, especially when we got into fall, like, there was an even bigger concentration of games than usual. And it just feels like that didn't stop. And normally, that just stops. Like, normally January is mostly dead. There's, like, one or two things in February. There's, like, one thing that comes out in March. One thing that comes out in May, and then nothing comes out over the summer, and then every single video game on the planet comes out in fall.
Especially because at the end of 2016, the industry as a whole took a hit because there was such a high density of really what would have been.
Yeah, a lot of games that were projected to sell a lot better than they did didn't sell that well, like Dishonored 2 and Titanfall 2 and stuff like that, that are good games. Yeah.
Dishonored 2 has done a little better in the time since then, but...
There are just so many games coming out all of a sudden.
But I wanted to hear like this plan. So I am planning to kind of play, finish Breath of the Wild, and then I think just stick with playing different Switch things until Persona 5 comes out, just so I can spend more time with this and kind of take it easy and not go insane. And then I'll play Persona 5, and then like at the end of April, I will probably decide where to go from there because there's not as many new things coming out. But then I'll probably have to go to Mass Effect. But Thomas, you're going to play Mass Effect, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's your next thing.
Well, I've only played two games this year, because I played Persona 3, which is 10 years old, and that took me 2 months, and then I played Breath of the Wild, which, because I sort of preemptively finished everything else I was supposed to do in the past 2 weeks, I was able to play that a little bit faster.
Yeah.
Mass Effect, I'm most excited for multiplayer. Huh. I assume the campaign will be fun. I assume it'll be kind of like Dragon Age Inquisition, where EA sort of got their paws on it a little more than I'm comfortable with, but I'll still enjoy it plenty. But the multiplayer was literally just revealed like over the weekend at PAX East.
I love Mass Effect 3.
Had really good multiplayer.
And it looks like they've sort of taken the more modern mobility elements of some other games, like they have a jetpack in this one, and just sort of applied that to it, so it'll be a lot of the same experience, just more modern. So I'm really excited for multiplayer.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's like I sort of have to focus on finishing all the schoolwork I have to do, especially for my recital. And then after that, I don't really know what I'm going to do.
Nice. So what's your game plan, Sean?
For me, the weirdest part is the Persona 5 part of the equation, because I have already played that game, but I want to play it again. And I feel like, obviously, I just sort of feel obligated to play it in English just to sort of like have that perspective on it as well. But I think maybe I get Mass Effect and kind of try to play them both at the same time, because I've already played Persona 5, if that's even possible.
Where are you playing Zelda in all of this?
I mean, now. I'm going to try to play as much Zelda as I can now, between now and when... I'm probably not going to get Mass Effect on launch day. Because I want to see the reviews either way, because if the reviews are not like... If the reviews are sort of a bit middling for that kind of game, I might just hold off on it for a while, because I also really want to play Nier Automata.
Yeah.
That game's not supposed to be quite as long, although it has like 500 like new game plus alternate ending things that is like a carryover from the original Nier. So maybe it is like 500 hours, and who knows? Every video game just feels like it's 500 hours these days.
Some of them are. So yeah, I'm lending you my Wii U to play Breath of the Wild, so you'll have that. But we'll see where we go from here. I mean, it's funny, like we're two people on this podcast, and we're able to kind of divide and conquer sometimes, but we can't cover everything.
Yeah.
We got Doctor Who coming back. We got...
That's actually really soon, isn't it?
April 15th. Yeah. Just over a month from now.
Man.
So, they had a new trailer today. Looks good.
Yeah.
And I like he's got a team again.
Yes. Yeah, it's been a long time. Yeah, it hasn't been since, like, I guess the 9th Doctor, 10th Doctor stuff. They had that a bit. Basically, we'll just go back all the way to the 5th Doctor's team.
Where depends on how you view Amy and Rory, but they're kind of like one companion in two bodies. It's a weird thing. So, yeah. Well, anyway, I think that's it for this week. Thomas, thank you for being here. This was fun.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah, so we got to talk about some good games.
Yeah. Glad to talk about Persona 3 again. It's, like you said, Sean, it's kind of an itch.
Yeah, you need to talk about it to people because it is such like a big personal experience playing those games. Yeah, for sure.
All right, well, we will be back next week, and we'll figure out what we're going to talk about, and the pile-up continues.
Yeah, I look forward to next week, because next week's episode, I'm just going to bitch about Twilight Princess the whole time.
Since I'm not here.
Yes.
Nice.